at the waist of another gown. There were two dark-haired women in the shop, one young and thin and trying to wipe her nose surreptitiously with the back of her hand, held a bolt of pale red silk clutched anxiously to her bosom. Her hair was a mass of long curls to her shoulders, in the Amadisian fashion, but it seemed a tangle beside the other woman's neat array. The other, handsome and in her middle years, was assuredly the seamstress, as proclaimed by the large, bristling pincushion fastened to her wrist. Her dress was of a good green wool, well cut and well made to show her skill, but only lightly worked with white flowers around the high neck, so as not to overshadow her patrons. When Nynaeve and Elaine walked in, both women gaped, as if none had entered in a year. The seamstress recovered first, regarding them with careful dignity as she made a slight curtsy. "May I serve you? I am Rhonda Macura. My shop is yours." "I want a dress embroidered with yellow roses on the bodice," Nynaeve told her. "But no thorns, mind," she added with a laugh. "I don't heal very fast." What she said did not matter, so long as she included yellow and heel in it. Now, if only that bunch of flowers was not happenstance. If that was the case, she would have to find some reason not to buy a dress with roses, and a way to keep Elaine from recounting the whole miserable experience to Tom and Julian. Mistress Macura stared at her for a moment with dark eyes, then turned to the thin girl, pushing her toward the back of the shop. "Go on to the kitchen, Lucy, and make a pot of tea for these good ladies. From the blue canister. The water's hot, thank the light. Go on, girl. Put that down and stop gawking. Quickly, quickly. The blue canister, mind. My best tea," she said, turning back to Nynaeve as the girl vanished through a door at the rear. "I live over the shop, you see, and my kitchen is in the back." She was smoothing her skirts nervously, thumb and forefinger of her right hand forming a circle, for the great serpent ring. There would be no need for an excuse about the dress, it seemed. Nynaeve repeated the sign, and after a moment Elaine did too. "I am Nynaeve, and this is Elaine. We saw your signal." The woman fluttered as if she might fly away. "The signal? Ah, yes, of course." "Well," Nynaeve said, "what is the urgent message?" "We should not talk about that out here, Mistress Nynaeve. Anyone might walk in." Nynaeve doubted that. "I will tell you over a nice cup of tea. My best tea, did I say?" Nynaeve exchanged looks with Elaine. If Mistress Macura was this reluctant to speak her news, it must be appalling indeed. "If we may just step into the back," Elaine said, "no one will hear but us." Her regal tone made the seamstress stare. For a moment, Nynaeve thought it might cut through her nervousness, but the next instant the fool woman was babbling again. "The tea will be ready in a moment. The water's already hot. We used to get Tarabonner tea through here. That is why I am here, I suppose. Not the tea, of course. All the trade that used to be and all the news that came both ways with the wagons, you are mainly interested in outbreaks of disease or a new kind of illness, but I find that interesting myself. I dabble a little with—" She coughed and rushed on. If she smoothed her dress any harder, she would wear a hole in it. "Some about the children, of course, but you are not much interested in them, really." "The kitchen, Mistress Macura," Nynaeve said firmly as soon as the other woman paused for breath. If the woman's news made her this afraid, Nynaeve would brook no more delay in hearing it. The door at the back opened enough to admit Lucy's anxious head. "It's ready, mistress," she announced breathlessly. "This way, Mistress Nynaeve," the seamstress said, still rubbing the front of her dress. "Mistress Elaine." A short hallway led past narrow stairs to a snug, beam-ceilinged kitchen with a steaming kettle sitting on the hearth and tall cupboards everywhere. Copper pots hung between the back door and a window that looked out into a small yard with a high wooden fence. The small table in the middle of the floor held a brilliant yellow teapot, a green honey jar, three mismatched cups in as many colors, and a squat blue pottery canister with the lid beside it. Mistress Makira snatched the canister, lidded it, and hastily put it into a cupboard that held more in 2 dozen shades and hues. "Sit, please," she said, filling the cups. "Please." Nynaeve took a ladder-back chair next to Elaine, and the seamstress set cups in front of them, flitting to one of the cupboards for pewter spoons. "The message?" Nynaeve said as the woman sat down across from them. Mistress Makira was too nervous to touch her own teacup, so Nynaeve stirred a little honey into hers and took a sip. It was hot, but had a cool, minty aftertaste. Hot tea might settle the woman's nerves, if she could be made to drink. "A pleasant taste," Elaine murmured over the edge of her cup. "What sort of tea is it?" "Good girl," Nynaeve thought. But the seamstress's hands only fluttered beside her cup. "A Tarabonner tea, from near the Shadow Coast." Sighing, Nynaeve took another swallow to settle her own stomach. "The message," she said insistently. "You did not hang that signal to invite us for tea. What is your urgent news?"
"Ah, yes."
Mistress Makura licked her lips, eyed them both, then said slowly, "It came near a month ago, with orders that any sister passing through heard it at all costs." She wet her lips again. "All sisters are welcome to return to the White Tower. The tower must be whole and strong." Nynaeve waited for the rest, but the other woman fell silent. This was the dire message? She looked at Elaine, but the heat seemed to be catching up to the girl. Drooping in her chair, she was staring at her hands on the table. "Is that all of it?" Nynaeve demanded, and surprised herself by yawning. The heat must be reaching her, too. The seamstress only watched her intently. "I said," Nynaeve began, but suddenly her head felt too heavy for her neck. Elaine had slumped onto the table, she realized, eyes closed and arms hanging limply. Nynaeve stared at the cup in her hands with horror.
"What did you give us?"
she said thickly. That minty taste was still there, but her tongue felt swollen.
"Tell me."
Letting the cup fall, she levered herself up against the table, knees wobbling.
"The light burn you. What?"
Mistress Makura scraped back her chair and stepped out of reach, but her earlier nervousness was now a look of quiet satisfaction. Blackness rolled in on Nynaeve. The last thing she heard was the seamstress's voice. "Catch her, Lucy." Chapter 10 Figs and Mice. Elaine realized that she was being carried upstairs by her shoulders and ankles. Her eyes opened, she could see, but the rest of her body might as well have belonged to someone else for all the control she had over it. Even blinking was slow. Her brain felt crammed full of feathers.
"She's awake, mistress,"
Lucy shrilled, nearly dropping her feet.
"She's looking at me."
"I told you not to worry," Mistress Makura's voice came from above her head. "She cannot channel or twitch a muscle, not with fork-root tea in her. I discovered that by accident, but it has certainly come in handy."
It was true.
Elaine sagged between them like a doll with half the stuffing gone, bumping her bottom along the steps, and she could as well have run as channel. She could sense the true source, but trying to embrace it was like trying to pick up a needle on a mirror with cold, numbed fingers. Panic welled up, and a tear slid down her cheek. Perhaps these women meant to turn her over to the White Cloaks for execution, but she could not make herself believe that the White Cloaks had women setting traps in the hope that an Aes Sedai might wander in. That left dark friends, and almost certainly serving the Black Aja right along with the Yellow. She would surely be put in the hands of the Black Aja unless Nynaeve had escaped. But if she was to escape, she could not count on anyone else, and she could neither move nor channel. Suddenly she realized that she was trying to scream and producing only a thin, gurgling mewl. Halting it took all the strength she had left. Nynaeve knew all about herbs, or claimed she did. Why had she not recognized whatever that tea was? Stop this whining. The small, firm voice in the back of her head sounded remarkably like Lini. A shoat squealing under a fence just attracts the fox when it should be trying to run. Desperately, she set herself to the simple task of embracing Saidar. It had been a simple task, but now she might as well have been attempting to reach Saidin. She kept on, though. It was the only thing she could do. Mistress Makura, at least, seemed to have no worry. As soon as they had dropped Elaine onto a narrow bed in a small, close room with one window, she hustled Lucy right out again, with not even a backward glance. Elaine's head had fallen so she could see another cramped bed and a high chest with tarnished brass pulls on the drawers. She could move her eyes, but shifting her head was beyond her. In a few minutes the two women returned, puffing, with Nynaeve slung between them, and heaved her onto the other bed. Her face was slack and glistening with tears, but her dark eyes... Fury filled them, and fear, too. Elaine hoped anger was uppermost. Nynaeve was stronger than she when she could channel. Perhaps Nynaeve could manage where she was failing miserably, time after time. Those had to be tears of rage. Telling the thin girl to stay there, Mistress Makura hurried out once more, this time coming back with a tray that she placed atop the high chest. It held the yellow teapot, one cup, a funnel, and a tall hourglass. "Now, Lucy, mind you pour a good 2 ounces into each of them as soon as that hourglass empties. As soon, mind."
"Why don't we give it to them now, mistress?" the girl moaned, wringing her hands. "I want them to go back to sleep. I don't like them looking at me."
"They would sleep like the dead girl, and this way we can let them rouse just enough to walk when we need them to. I will dose them more properly when it's time to send them off. They'll have headaches and stomach cramps to pay for it, but no more than they deserve, I suppose."
"But what if they can channel, mistress? What if they do? They're looking at me."
"Stop blathering, girl," the older woman said briskly. "If they could, don't you think they would have by now? They are helpless as kittens in a sack, and they will stay that way as long as you keep a good dose in them. Now you do as I told you, understand? I must go tell old Avi to send off one of his pigeons and make a few arrangements, but I will be back as soon as I can. You had better brew another pot of fork root, just in case. I'll go out the back. Close up the shop. Someone might wander in, and that would never do." After Mistress Makura left, Lucy stood staring at them for a while, still wringing her hands, then finally scurried out herself. Her sniffling faded down the stairs. Elaine could see sweat beading on Nynaeve's brow. She hoped it was effort, not the heat. "Try, Nynaeve." She herself reached for the true source, fumbling clumsily through the wads of wool that seemed to pack her head. Failed, tried again and failed, tried again. "Oh, light, try, Nynaeve, try." The hourglass filled her eyes. She could not look at anything else. Sand pouring down, each grain marking another failure on her part. The last grain dropped, and Lucy did not come. Elaine strained harder for the source to move. After a bit, the fingers of her left hand twitched. Yes! A few minutes more and she could lift her hand. Only a feeble inch before it fell again, but it had lifted. With an effort, she could turn her head.
"Fight it,"
Nynaeve mumbled thickly, barely intelligible. Her hands were gripping the coverlet under her tightly. She seemed to be trying to sit up. Not even her head lifted, but she was trying.
I am,
Elaine tried to say. It sounded more like a grunt to her ears. Slowly she managed to raise her hand to where she could see it and hold it there. A thrill of triumph shot through her. "Stay afraid of us, Lucy. Stay down there in the kitchen a little while longer and—" The door banged open, and sobs of frustration racked her as Lucy dashed in. She had been so close. The girl took one look at them and with a yelp of pure terror darted for the high chest. Elaine tried to fight her, but thin as she was, Lucy batted her floundering hands away effortlessly, forced the funnel between her teeth just as easily. The girl panted as if running. Cold, bitter tea filled Elaine's mouth. She stared up at the girl in a panic that Lucy's face shared. But Lucy held Elaine's mouth shut and stroked her throat with a grim, if fearful, determination until she swallowed. As darkness overwhelmed Elaine, she could hear liquid sounds of protest coming from Nynaeve. When her eyes opened again, Lucy was gone, and the sands trickled through the glass again. Nynaeve's dark eyes were bulging, whether in fear or anger Elaine could not have said. No, Nynaeve would not give in. That was one of the things she admired in the other woman. Nynaeve's head could have been on the chopping block, and she would not give up. Our heads are on the block. It made her ashamed that she was so much weaker than Nynaeve. She was supposed to be Queen of Andor one day, and she wanted to howl with terror. She did not, even in her head. Doggedly, she went back to trying to force her limbs to move, to trying to touch Sidar, but she wanted to. How could she ever be a queen when she was so weak? Again she reached for the source. Again, again, racing the grains of sand. Again. Once more the glass emptied itself without Lucy. Ever so slowly she reached the point where she could raise her hand again, and then her head, even if it did flop back immediately. She could hear Nynaeve muttering to herself, and she could actually understand most of the words. The door crashed open once more. Elaine lifted her head to stare at it despairingly, and gaped. Tom Marilyn stood there like the hero of one of his own tales, one hand firmly gripping the neck of a Lucy near fainting, the other holding a knife ready to throw. Elaine laughed delightedly, though it came out more like a croak. Roughly he shoved the girl into a corner.
"You stay there, or I'll strop this blade on your hide."
In two steps he was at Elaine's side, smoothing her hair back, worry painting his leathery face.
"What did you give them, girl? Tell me, or—"
"Not her," Nynaeve muttered. "Other one. Went away. Help me up. Have to walk."
Tom left her, reluctantly, Elaine thought. He showed Lucy his knife again, threateningly. She cowered as if she never meant to move again, then made it disappear up his sleeve in a twinkling. Hauling Nynaeve to her feet, he began walking her up and down the few paces the room allowed. She sagged against him limply, shuffling.
"I'm glad to hear this frightened little cat didn't trap you," he said. "If she had been the one—"
He shook his head. No doubt he would think just as little of them if Nynaeve told him the truth. Elaine certainly did not intend to.
"I found her rushing up the stairs, so panicked she did not even hear me behind her. I'm not so glad that another one got away without Julin seeing her. Is she likely to bring others back?"
Elaine rolled over onto her side.
"I do not think so, Tom," she mumbled. "She can't let too many people know about herself."
In another minute she might be able to sit up. She was looking right at Lucy. The girl flinched and tried to shrink through the wall.
"The white cloaks would take her as quickly as they would us."
"Julin?"
Nynaeve said. Her head wavered as she glared up at the Glee Man. She had no trouble speaking, though. "I told the pair of you to stay with the wagon." Tom blew out his mustaches irritably.
"You told us to put up the supplies, which did not take two men. Julin followed you, and when none of you came back, I went looking for him."
He snorted again.
"For all he knew, there were a dozen men in here, but he was ready to come in after you alone. He is tying Skulker in the back. A good thing I decided to ride in. I think we'll need the horse to get you two out of here."
Elaine found that she could sit up, barely, pulling herself hand over hand along the coverlet, but an effort to stand nearly put her flat again. Sidar was as unobtainable as ever. Her head still felt like a goose-down pillow. Nynaeve was beginning to hold herself a little straighter, to lift her feet, but she still hung on Tom. Minutes later, Julin arrived, pushing Mistress Makura ahead of him with his belt knife.
"She came through a gate in the back fence. Thought I was a thief. It seemed best to bring her on in."
The seamstress's face had gone so pale at the sight of them that her eyes seemed darker and about to come out of her head besides. She licked her lips and smoothed her skirt incessantly, and cast quick little glances at Julin's knife, as if wondering whether it might not be best to run away. For the most part, though, she stared at Elaine and Nynaeve. Elaine thought it an even chance whether she would burst into tears or swoon. "Put her over there," Nynaeve said, nodding to where Lucy still shivered in the corner with her arms wrapped around her knees. "And help Elaine. I never heard of fork root, but walking seems to help the effects pass. You can walk most things off." Julin pointed to the corner with his knife, and Mistress Makura scurried to it and sat herself down beside Lucy, still wetting her lips fearfully.
"I would not have done what I did, only I had orders. You must understand that. I had orders."
Gently helping Elaine to her feet, Julin supported her in walking the few steps available, crisscrossing the other pair. She wished it were Tom. Julin's arm around her waist was much too familiar.
"Orders from whom?" Nynaeve barked. "Who do you report to in the tower?"
The seamstress looked sick, but she clamped her mouth shut determinedly.
"If you don't talk," Nynaeve told her, scowling, "I'll let Julin have you. He's a tyrant thief-catcher, and he knows how to bring out a confession as quickly as any white-cloak questioner. Don't you, Julin?"
"Some rope to tie her," he said, grinning a grin so villainous that Elaine almost tried to step away from him. "Some rags to gag her until she is ready to talk. Some cooking oil and salt."
His chuckle curdled Elaine's blood.
"She will talk."
Mistress Makura held herself rigidly against the wall, staring at him, eyes as wide as they would go. Lucy looked at him as if he had just turned into a trollic, 8 feet tall and complete with horns.
"Very well," Nynaeve said after a moment. "You should find everything you need in the kitchen, Julin."
Elaine shifted a startled look from her to the thief-catcher and back. Surely they did not really mean to... Not Nynaeve.
"Narenwin Barda,"
the seamstress gasped suddenly. Words tripped over one another, spilling out of her.
"I send my reports to Narenwin Barda, at an inn in Tarvalin called the Upriver Run. Avi Shendar keeps pigeons for me on the edge of town. He doesn't know who I send messages to or who I get them from, and he does not care. His wife has the falling sickness, and..."
She trailed off, shuddering and watching Julin.
Elaine knew Narenwin, or at least had seen her in the tower. A thin little woman you could forget was there, she was so quiet, and kind, too. One day a week she let children bring their pets to the tower grounds for her to heal. Hardly the sort of woman to be Black Aja. On the other hand, one of the Black Aja names they knew was Marilyn Gamolfin. She liked cats, and went out of her way to look after strays.
"Narenwin Barda," Nynaeve said grimly. "I want more names, inside the tower or out."
"I don't have any more," Mistress Makura said faintly.
"We will see about that. How long have you been a dark friend? How long have you served the Black Aja?"
An indignant squall erupted from Lucy.
"We aren't dark friends."
She glanced at Mistress Makura and sidled away from her.
"At least I'm not. I walk in the light, I do."
The other woman's reaction was no less strong. If her eyes had bulged before, they popped now.
"The Black? You mean it really exists? But the tower has always denied. Why, I asked Narenwin the day she chose me for the Yellow's eyes and ears, and it was the next morning before I could stop weeping and crawl out of my bed. I am not a dark friend. Never. I serve the Yellow Aja. The Yellow."
Still hanging on to Julin's arm, Elaine exchanged puzzled looks with Nynaeve. Any dark friend would deny it, of course, but there seemed a ring of truth in the women's voices. Their outrage at the accusation was nearly enough to overcome their fear. From the way Nynaeve hesitated, she heard the same thing.
If you serve the yellow, she said slowly, why did you drug us?
It was her, the seamstress replied, nodding at Elaine. I was sent her description a month since, right down to that way she holds her chin sometimes, so she seems to be looking down at you. Narenwin said she might use the name Elaine, and even claimed to be of a noble house. Word by word, her anger over being called a dark friend seemed to bubble higher. Maybe you are a yellow sister, but she's no Aes Sedai, just a runaway accepted. Narenwin said I was to report her presence and that of anyone with her, and to delay her if I could, or even capture her, and anyone with her. How they expected me to capture an accepted, I do not know. I don't think even Narenwin knows about my fork root tea, but that is what my orders said. They said I should risk exposure even, here, where it'd be my death, if I had to. You just wait until the Ammerlin puts her hands on you, young woman, on all of you.
The Ammerlin? Elaine exclaimed. What does she have to do with this?
It was on her orders. By order of the Ammerlin's seat, it said. It said the Ammerlin herself said I could use any means short of killing you. You will wish you were dead when the Ammerlin gets hold of you.
Her sharp nod was full of furious satisfaction.
Remember that we are not in anyone's hands yet, Nynaeve said dryly. You are in ours. Her eyes looked as shocked as Elaine felt, though. Was any reason given?
The reminder that she was the captive sapped the brief burst of spirit from the woman. She sagged listlessly against Lucy, each keeping the other from falling over.
No. Sometimes Narenwin gives a reason, but not this time.
Did you intend to just keep us here drugged until someone came for us?
I was going to send you off by cart, dressed in some old clothes. Not even a shred of resistance remained in the woman's voice. I sent a pigeon to tell Narenwin you were here and what I was doing. Theron Lugay owes me a strong favor, and I meant to give him enough fork root to last all the way to Tar Valon, if Narenwin didn't send sisters to meet you sooner. He thinks you are ill, and the tea is the only thing keeping you alive until an Aes Sedai can heal you. A woman has to be careful, dealing in remedies in Amadicia. Cure too many or too well, somebody whispers Aes Sedai, and the next you know your house is burning down, or worse. Theron knows to hold his tongue about what he... Nynaeve made Tom help her closer, where she could stare down at the seamstress.
And the message? The real message? You did not put that signal out in the hope of luring us in.
I gave you the real message, the woman said wearily. I did not think it could do any harm. I don't understand it, and I... Please!
Suddenly she was sobbing, clinging to Lucy as hard as the younger woman did to her, both of them wailing and babbling.
Please, don't let him use the salt on me. Please, not the salt. Oh, please.
Tie them up, Nynaeve said disgustedly after a moment, and we will go downstairs where we can talk. Tom helped her to sit on the edge of the nearest bed, then quickly cut strips from the other coverlet. In short order, both women were bound, back to back, the hands of one to the feet of the other, with wadded bits of coverlet tied in for gags. The pair were still weeping when Tom assisted Nynaeve from the room. Elaine wished she could walk as well as the other woman, but she still needed Julin's support not to go tumbling down the stairs. She felt a small stab of jealousy watching Tom with his arm around Nynaeve.
You are a foolish little girl, Linny's voice said sharply. I'm a grown woman, she told it with a firmness she would not have dared with her old nurse, even today. I do love Rand, but he is far away, and Tom is sophisticated and intelligent, and...
It sounded too much like excuses, even to her. Linny would have given the snort that meant she was about to stop tolerating foolishness.
Julin, she asked hesitantly, what were you going to do with the salt and the cooking oil?
Not exactly, she added more quickly. Just a general idea.
He looked at her for a moment. I do not know. But they did not either. That is the trick of it.
their minds made up worse than I ever could. I have seen a tough man break when I sent for a basket of figs and some mice. You have to be careful, though. Some will confess anything, true or not, just to escape what they imagine. I do not think those two did, though. She did not either. She could not repress a shiver, however. What would somebody do with figs and mice? She hoped she stopped wondering before she gave herself nightmares. By the time they reached the kitchen, Nynaeve was tottering about without help, poking into the cupboard full of colorful canisters. Elaine needed one of the chairs. The blue canister sat on the table and a full green teapot, but she tried not to look at them. She still could not channel. She could embrace Sidar, yet it slipped away as soon as she did. At least she was confident now that the power would return to her. The alternative was too horrible to contemplate, and she had not let herself until this moment. "Tom," Nynaeve said, lifting the lids on various containers and peering in. "Juelin." She paused, took a deep breath, and still not looking at the two men, said, "Thank you. I begin to see why Aes Sedai have warders. Thank you very much." Not all Aes Sedai did. Reds considered all men tainted because of what men who could channel did, and a few never bothered because they did not leave the tower or simply did not replace a warder who died. The Greens were the only Aja to allow bonding with more than one warder. Elaine wanted to be a Green. Not for that reason, of course, but because the Greens called themselves the Battle Aja. Where Browns searched for lost knowledge and Blues involved themselves in causes, Green Sisters held themselves ready for the last battle, when they would go forth, as they had in the Trolloc Wars, to face new Dreadlords. The two men stared at one another in open amazement. They had surely been ready for the usual rough side of Nynaeve's tongue. Elaine was almost as shocked. Nynaeve liked having to be helped as much as she liked being wrong. Either made her as prickly as a briar, though of course she always claimed to be a picture of sweet reason and sense. "A wisdom." Nynaeve took a pinch of powder from one of the canisters and sniffed it, touched it to the tip of her tongue. "Or whatever they call it here." "They don't have a name for it here," Tom said. "Not many women follow your old craft in Amadicia. Too dangerous. For most of those, it's only a sideline." Pulling a leather scrip from the bottom of the cupboard, Nynaeve began making up small bundles from some of the containers. "And who do they go to when they're ill? A hedge doctor?" "Yes," Elaine said. It always pleased her to show Tom that she knew things about the world, too. "In Amadicia, it is men who study herbs." Nynaeve frowned scornfully. "What could a man ever know about curing anything? I'd as soon ask a farrier to make a dress." Abruptly, Elaine realized that she had been thinking of anything and everything except what Mistress Makura had said. "Not thinking about a thorn doesn't make it hurt your foot less." One of Lini's favorites. "Nynaeve, what do you think that message means? All sisters are welcome to return to the tower? It makes no sense." That was not what she wanted to say, but at least she was closing in on it. "The tower has its own rules," Tom said. "What Aes Sedai do, they do for reasons of their own, and often not for those they give, if they give reasons at all." He and Juelin knew they were only accepted, of course. That was at least part of why neither man did as he was told nearly as well as he might. The struggle was plain on Nynaeve's face. She did not like being interrupted or people answering for her. There was quite a list of things Nynaeve did not like. But it was only a moment since she'd thanked Tom. It could not be easy to call down a man who had just saved you from being hauled off like a cabbage. "Very little in the tower makes sense most of the time," she said sourly. Elaine suspected that the tartness was as much for Tom as the tower. "Do you believe what she said?" Elaine took a deep breath. "About the Ammerlin saying I was to be brought back by any means?" The brief look Nynaeve gave her was touched with sympathy. "I don't know, Elaine."
She was telling the truth.
Jewelin turned one of the chairs around and straddled it, leaning his staff against the back.
I've questioned enough thieves and murderers to know truth when I hear it. Part of the time she was too frightened to lie, and the rest too angry.
The pair of you! Taking a deep breath, Nynaeve tossed the scrip onto the table and folded her arms as if to trap her hands away from her braid. I am afraid Jewelin is probably right, Elaine.
But the Amarlin knows what we are doing. She sent us out of the tower in the first place.
Nynaeve sniffed loudly.
I can believe anything of Swan Sanche. I would like to have her for 1 hour where she could not channel. We would see how tough she is then.
Elaine did not think that would make any difference. Remembering that commanding blue gaze, she suspected Nynaeve would earn a fine lot of bruises in the unlikely event that she ever got her wish.
But what are we to do about it? The Ajahs have eyes and ears everywhere, it seems, and the Amarlin herself. We could have women trying to slip things into our food all the way to Tar Valon.
Not if we do not look like what they expect.
Lifting a yellow jug out of the cupboard, Nynaeve set it on the table beside the teapot.
This is white hen pepper. It will soothe a toothache, but it will also turn your hair black as night.
Elaine put a hand to her red-gold tresses. Her hair, not Nynaeve's, she would wager. But as much as she hated the idea, it was a good one. A little needlework on some of those dresses in the front, and we are not merchants any more, but two ladies traveling with their servants.
Riding on a wagon load of dye, Jewelin said.
Her level look said gratitude for saving her extended only so far. There is a coach in a stable yard on the other side of the bridge. I think the owner will sell it. If you go back to the wagon before somebody steals it, I do not know what got into you two, just leaving it for whoever came along. If it is still there, you can take one of the purses. A few people goggled when Noy Torvald's coach pulled up in front of Rhonda Macura's shop, drawn by a team of four, with chests strapped to the roof and a saddled horse tied on behind. Noy had lost everything when the trade with Tarabon collapsed. He was scraping a living doing odd jobs for Widow Terran now. No one in the street had ever seen the coachman before, a tall, leathery fellow with long white mustaches and cold, imperious eyes, or the dark, hard-faced footman in a Tarabonner hat, who jumped down nimbly to open the coach door. The goggling turned to murmurs when two women swept out of the shop with bundles in their arms. One wore a green silk gown, the other plain blue wool, but each had a scarf wrapped around her head so that not so much as a hint of her hair was visible. They all but leaped into the coach. Two of the children began sauntering over to inquire who the strangers were, but while the footman was still scrambling up to the driver's seat, the coachman cracked his long whip, shouting something about making way for a lady. Her name was lost as the children threw themselves out of the way, tumbling in the dusty street, and the coach rumbled away at a gallop toward the Amador Road. The onlookers walked away, talking among themselves. A mysterious lady, obviously, with her maid, making purchases from Rhonda Macura and rushing away from the children. Little enough happened in Mardisan of late, and this would provide days of conversation. The Children of the Light brushed themselves off furiously, but finally decided that reporting the incident would make them look foolish. Besides, their captain did not like nobles. He would probably send them to bring the coach back, a long ride in the heat for no more than an arrogant young sprig of one house or another. If no charges could be brought, always tricky with the nobility, it would not be the captain who took the blame. Hoping that word of their humiliation did not spread, they certainly never thought of questioning Rhonda Macura. A short time later, Theron Lugay led his cart into the yard behind the shop, provisions for the long journey ahead already packed away under the round canvas top. Indeed, Rhonda Macura had cured him of a fever that had taken 23 the winter before, but it was a nagging wife and a shrewish mother-in-law that made him glad of a journey all the way to where the witches lived. Rhonda had said someone might meet him, though not who, but he hoped to make it to Tar Valon. He tapped on the kitchen door 6 times before going in, but it was not until he climbed the stairs that he found anyone. In the back bedroom, Rhonda and Lucy lay stretched out on the beds, sound asleep and fully clothed, if rather rumpled, with the sun still in the sky. Neither woman roused when he shook them. He did not understand that, or why one of the coverlets was lying on the floor cut into knotted strips, or why there were 2 empty teapots in the room but only 1 cup, or why a funnel was lying on Rhonda's pillow. But he had always known that there was a great deal in the world he did not understand. Returning to his cart, he thought about the supplies Rhonda's money had purchased, thought of his wife and her mother, and when he led the cart horse off, it was with the intention of seeing what Altara was like, or maybe Mirandi. One way and another, it was quite a time before a disheveled Rhonda Macura tottered up to Avi Shendar's house and sent off a pigeon, a thin bone tube tied to its leg. The bird launched itself north and east, straight as an arrow toward Tar Valon. After a moment's thought, Rhonda prepared another copy on another narrow strip of thin parchment and fastened it to a bird from another coop. That one headed west, for she had promised to send duplicates of all of her messages. In these hard times, a woman had to make out as best she could, and there could be no harm in it. Not the sort of reports she made to Narenwin. Wondering if she could ever get the taste of fork root out of her mouth, she would not have minded if the report brought just a little harm to the one who called herself Nynaeve. Hoeing in his garden patch as usual, Avi paid no attention to what Rhonda did, and as usual, as soon as she was gone, he washed his hands and went inside. She had placed a larger sheet of parchment underneath the strips to cushion the nib of the pen. When he held it up to the afternoon light, he could make out what she had written. Soon a third pigeon was on its way, heading in still another direction. Chapter 11. The Nine-Horse Hitch. A wide straw hat shaded Swan's face as she let Loghain lead the way through Lugard's Shileen Gate under the late afternoon sun. The city's tall gray outer walls were in some disrepair. In 2 places, she could see, tumbled stone lowered the wall to no more than a tall fence. Min and Lyanna rode close behind her, both tired from the pace the man had set over the weeks since Core Springs. He wanted to be in charge, and it took little enough to convince him that he was. If he said when they started of a morning, when and where they stopped of a night, if he kept the money, even if he expected them to serve his meals as well as cook them, it was of little account to her. All in all, she felt sorry for him. He had no idea what she planned for him. A big fish on the hook to catch a bigger, she thought grimly. In name, Lugard was the capital of Mirandi, the seat of King Roedran. But lords in Mirandi spoke the words of fealty, then refused to pay their taxes, or do much of anything else that Roedran wanted, and the people did the same. Mirandi was a nation in name only, the people barely held together by supposed allegiance to the king or queen. The throne changed hands at sometimes short intervals, and fear that Andor or Ilion might snap them up if they did not hold together in some fashion. Stone walls crisscrossed the city, most in a worse state than the outer bastions, for Lugard had grown haphazardly over the centuries, and more than once had actually been divided among feuding nobles. It was a dirty city, many of the broad streets unpaved and all of them dusty. Men in high-crowned hats and aproned women in skirts that showed their ankles dodged between merchants' lumbering trains, while children played in wagon ruts. Trade kept Lugard alive. Trade up from Ilion and Ebudar, from Gialdan to the west and Andor to the north. Large, bare patches of ground through the city held wagons parked wheel to wheel, many heavy-laden under strapped-down canvas covers, others empty and awaiting freight. Inns lined the main streets, along with horse lots and stables, nearly outnumbering the gray stone houses or shops, all roofed with tiles in blue or red or purple or green. Dust and noise filled the air, clanging from the smithies, the rumble of wagons and curses of the drivers, boisterous laughter from the inns. The sun baked Lugard as it slid toward the horizon, and the air felt as though it might never rain again. When Loghain finally turned into a stable yard and dismounted behind a green-roofed inn called the Nine Horse Hitch, Suan clambered down from Bella gratefully and gave the shaggy mare a doubtful pat on the nose, wary of teeth. In her view, sitting on the back of an animal was no way to travel. A boat went as you turned the rudder. A horse might decide to think for itself. Boats never bit, either. Bella had not so far, but she could. At least those awful first days of stiffness were gone, when she was sure Lyanna and Min were grinning behind her back as she hobbled about in the evening camp. After a day in the saddle, she still felt as if she had been thoroughly beaten, but she managed to hide it. As soon as Loghain began bargaining with the stableman, a lanky, freckled old fellow in a leather vest and no shirt, Suan sidled close to Lyanna. "If you want to practice your wiles," she said softly, "practice them on Dalin the next hour." Lyanna gave her a dubious look. She had dabbled in smiles and glances at some of the villages since Core Springs, but Loghain had gotten no more than a flat look, then sighed and nodded. Taking a deep breath, she glided forward in that startling, sinuous way, leading her arch-necked gray and already smiling at Loghain. Suan could not see how she did that. It was as if some of her bones were no longer rigid. Moving over to Min, she spoke just as quietly again. "The instant Dalin is done with the stableman, tell him you are going to join me inside. Then hurry ahead, and stay away from him and Amena until I come back." From the noise roaring out of the inn, the crowd inside was big enough to hide an army. Surely big enough to hide the absence of one woman. Min got that mulish look about her eyes and opened her mouth, no doubt to demand why. Suan forestalled her. "Just do it, Serenla, or I'll let you add cleaning his boots to handing him his plate." The stubborn look remained, but Min gave a sullen nod. Pushing Bella's reins into the other woman's hands, Suan hurried out of the stable yard and started down the street in what she hoped was the right direction. She did not want to have to search the entire city, not in this heat and dust. Heavy wagons behind teams of 6 or 8 or even 10 filled the streets, drivers cracking long whips and cursing equally at the horses and at the people who darted between the wagons. Roughly dressed men mingling through the crowds in long wagon drivers' coats sometimes directed laughing invitations at women who passed them. The women who wore colorful aprons, sometimes striped, their heads wrapped in bright scarves, walked on with eyes straight ahead, as though they did not hear. Women without aprons, hair hanging loose around their shoulders, and skirts sometimes ending a foot or more clear of the ground, often shouted back even ruder replies. Suan gave a start when she realized that some of the men's suggestions were aimed at her. They did not make her angry. She really could not apply them to herself in her own mind, only startled. She was still not used to the changes in her, that men might find her attractive. Her reflection in the filthy window of a tailor's shop caught her eye, not much more than a murky image of a fair-skinned girl under a straw hat. She was young, not just young-appearing, as far as she could tell, but young, not much older than Min, a girl, in truth, from the vantage of the years she had actually lived. "An advantage to having been stilled," she told herself. She had met women who would pay any price to lose 15 or 20 years. Some might even consider her price a fair bargain. She often found herself listing such advantages, perhaps trying to convince herself they were real. Freed from the 3 oaths, she could lie at need, for one thing, and her own father would not have recognized her. She did not really look as she had as a young woman. The changes maturity had made were still there, but softened into youth.
Coldly objective, she thought she might be somewhat prettier than she had been as a girl. Pretty was the best that had ever been said of her. Handsome had been the more usual compliment. She could not connect that face to her, to Suan Sanche. Only inside was she still the same, her mind yet held all its knowledge. There, in her head, she was still herself. Some of the inns and taverns in Lugard had names like the Farrier's Hammer, or the Dancing Bear, or the Silver Pig, often with garish signs painted to match. Others had names that should not have been allowed, the mildest of that sort being the Domani Wench's Kiss, with a painting of a coppery-skinned woman, bare to the waist, with her lips puckered. Swan wondered what Liana would make of that, but the way the woman was now, it might only give her notions. At last, on a side street just as wide as the main, just beyond a gateless opening in one of the collapsing inner walls, she found the inn she wanted, 3 stories of rough gray stone topped with purple roof tiles. The sign over the door had an improbably voluptuous woman wearing only her hair, arranged to hide as little as possible, astride a bare-backed horse, and a name that she skipped over as soon as she recognized it. Inside, the common room was blue with pipe smoke, packed with raucous men drinking and laughing, trying to pinch serving maids, who dodged as best they could with long-suffering smiles. Barely audible over the babble, a zither and a flute accompanied a young woman singing and dancing on a table at one end of the long room. Occasionally the singer swirled her skirts high enough to show nearly the whole length of her bare legs. What Swan could catch of her song made her want to go wash out the girl's mouth. Why would a woman go walking with no clothes on? Why would a woman sing about it to a lot of drunken louts? It was not a sort of place she had ever been into before. She intended to make this visit as brief as possible. There was no mistaking the inn's owner, a tall, heavy-set woman encased in a red silk dress that practically glowed. Elaborate dyed curls. Nature had never produced that shade of red, surely never with such dark eyes. Framed a thrusting chin and a hard mouth. In between shouting orders to the serving girls, she stopped at this table or that to speak a few words or slap a back and laugh with her patrons. Swan held herself stiffly and tried to ignore the considering looks men gave her as she approached the crimson-haired woman. "Mistress Tharn?" She had to repeat the name 3 times, each louder than the last, before the inn's owner looked at her. "Mistress Tharn, I want a job singing. I can sing—"
"You can you now?" the big woman laughed. "Well, I have a singer, but I can always use another to give her a rest. Let me be seeing your legs." "I can sing the song of the 3 fishes, Swan said loudly.
This had to be the right woman. Surely 2 women in 1 city could not have hair like that. Not and answer to the right name at the right inn. Mistress Tharn laughed harder still and slapped one of the men at the nearest table on the shoulder, jolting him half off his bench.
"Not much call for that one here, eh, Pell?"
Gap-toothed Pell, a wagon driver's whip curled around his shoulder, cackled with her.
"And I can sing Blue Sky Dawning."
The woman shook, scrubbing at her eyes as though she had laughed herself to tears.
"Can you now? I'm sure the lads will love that. Now let me see your legs. Your legs, girl, or get out."
Swan hesitated, but Mistress Tharn only stared at her, and an increasing number of the men did, too. This had to be the right woman. Slowly she pulled her skirt up to her knees. The tall woman gestured impatiently. Closing her eyes, Swan gathered more and more of her skirt in her hands. She felt her face growing redder by the inch.
"A modest one," Mistress Tharn chortled. "Well, if those songs are the extent of your knowledge, you'd better have legs to make a man fall on his face. Can't tell till we get those woolen stockings off her, eh, Pell? Well, come on with me. Maybe you have a voice anyway, but I can't hear it in here. Come on, girl. Hustle your rump."
Swan's eyes snapped open, blazing, but the big woman was already striding toward the back of the common room. backbone like an iron rod, Swan let her skirts fall and followed, trying to ignore the guffaws and lewd suggestions directed at her. Her face was stone, but inside worry warred with anger. Before being raised to the Ammerlin seat, she had run the Blue Aja's network of eyes and ears. Some had also been her own personal listeners, both then and later. She might no longer be Ammerlin, or even Aes Sedai, but she still knew all of those agents. Jorunda Tharn had already been serving the Blue when she took over the network, a woman whose information was always timely. Eyes and ears were not to be found everywhere, and their reliability varied. There had been only one that she trusted enough to approach between Tar Valon and here, at Four Kings, in Andor, and she had vanished. But a vast amount of news and rumor passed through Lugard with the merchants' wagon trains. There might be eyes and ears for other Ajahs here. It would be well to remember that. Caution gets the boat home, she reminded herself. This woman fit the description of Jorunda Tharn perfectly, and surely no other inn could have a name so vile. But why had she responded as she did when Swan identified herself as another agent of the Blue? She had to risk it. Min and Lyanna, in their own fashion, were growing as impatient as Loghain. Caution got the boat home, but sometimes boldness brought back a full hold. At the worst, she could knock the woman over the head with something and escape out the back. Eyeing the woman's width and height, and the firmness of her thick arms, she hoped that she could. A plain door in the corridor that led to the kitchens opened into a sparsely furnished room, a desk and one chair on a scrap of blue carpet, a large mirror on one wall, and, surprisingly, a short shelf with a few books. As soon as the door was shut behind them, diminishing if not cutting off the noise of the common room, the big woman rounded on Swan, fists planted on ample hips. "Now then, what do you want with me? Don't bother giving me a name. I don't want to know whether it's yours or not." A little of the tension oozed out of Swan, not the anger, though. "You had no right to treat me in that manner out there. What did you mean, forcing me to—" "I had every right," Mistress Tharn snapped, "and every necessity. If you'd come at opening or closing, as you're supposed to, I could have hustled you in here and none the wiser. Do you think some of those men wouldn't be wondering if I escorted you back here like a long-lost friend? I can't afford to have anyone wondering about me. You're lucky I didn't make you take Susu's place on the table for a song or two. And you watch your manner with me." She raised a wide, hard hand threateningly. "I've married daughters older than you, and when I visit them, they step right and talk proper. You come, Mistress Snip, with me, and you'll be learning why. Nobody out there will even hear you yelp, and if they did, they wouldn't interfere." With a sharp nod, as if that were settled, she put fists on hips again. "Now, what do you want?" Several times during the onslaught, Swan had tried to speak, but the woman rolled over her like a tidal wave. That was not something she was accustomed to. By the time Mistress Tharn was done, she quivered with anger. Both hands held her skirts in a white-knuckled grip. She held on to her temper every bit as hard. "I am supposed to be just another agent," she reminded herself firmly. "Not the Ammerlin anymore, just another agent." Besides, she suspected that the woman might carry out her threat. This was something else still new to her, having to be wary of someone under her eye just because they were larger and stronger. "I was given a message to deliver to a gathering of those we serve." She hoped Mistress Tharn took the strain in her voice for being cowed. The woman might be more helpful if she thought Swan properly intimidated. "They were not where I was told to find them. I can only hope you know something to help me find them." Folding her arms under a massive bosom, Mistress Tharn studied her. "Know how to hold your temper when it suits, eh? Good. What's happened in the tower? And don't try denying you come from there, my fine haughty wench. Your message has courier writ large all over it, and you never got that snooty manner in a village." Swan drew a deep breath before answering. "Swan Sanche has been stilled." Her voice did not even tremble. She was proud of that. "Elida Arroyhan is the new Ammerlin.
She could not keep a hint of bite out of that, however. Mistress Thorne's face showed no reaction.
Well, that explains some of the orders I've gotten. Some of them, maybe. Stilled her, did they? I thought she'd be Amarlin forever. I saw her once a few years ago in Camelin, at a distance. She looked like she could chew harness straps for breakfast.
Those impossible scarlet curls swung as she shook her head.
Well, done's done. The Ajahs have split, haven't they? Only one thing that fits. My orders and the old buzzard stilled. The tower's broken and the blues are running.
Swan ground her teeth. She tried telling herself the woman was loyal to the blue Aja, not to her personally, but it did not help.
Old buzzard? She's old enough to be my mother, and if she was, I'd drown myself.
With an effort, she made her voice meek.
My message is important. I must be on my way as soon as possible. Can you help me?
Important, is it? Well, I'm doubting it. Trouble is, I can give you something, but it's up to you to cipher it out. Do you want it?
The woman refused to make this any easier.
Yes, please.
Sally Deira. I don't know who she is or was, but I was told to give her name to any blue who came around looking lost, so to speak. You may not be one of the sisters, but you carry your nose high enough for one, so there it is. Sally Deira. Make of it what you will.
Swan suppressed a thrill of excitement and made her face dejected.
I've never heard of her either. I'll just have to go on looking. If you find them, you tell Aeldine Sedai I'm still loyal, whatever's happened. I've worked for the Blues so long I wouldn't know what to do with myself else.
I will tell her, Swan said. She had not known that Aeldine was her replacement controlling the Blues' eyes and ears. The Amarlin, whatever Aja she came from, was of all but part of none.
I suppose you need some reason for not hiring me. I really cannot sing. That should do.
As if it mattered to that lot out there.
The big woman quirked an eyebrow and grinned in a way Swan did not like.
I'll think of something, wench, and I'll give you a bit of advice. If you don't climb down a rung or two, some Aes Sedai will take you down the whole ladder. I'm surprised it hasn't been done already. Now go on. Get out of here.
Hateful woman, Swan growled in her head. If there was a way to manage it, I'd have her doing penance till her eyes popped.
The woman thought she deserved more respect, did she?
Thank you for your help, she said coolly, making a curtsy that would have graced any court. You have been too kind.
She was three steps into the common room when Mistress Tharn appeared behind her, raising her voice in a laughing shout that cut through the noise.
A shy maiden, that one. Legs white and slender enough to set you all drooling, and she bawled like a baby when I told her she'd have to show them to you. Just sat right down on the floor and cried. Hips round enough for any taste, and she...
Swan stumbled as the tide of laughter rose, never quite drowning out the woman's recitation. She managed another three steps, face red as a beet, then fled at a run. In the street she paused to get her breath back and let her heart stop pounding.
That horrible old harridan! I should...
It did not matter what she should do. That disgusting woman had told her what she needed. Not Sally Deira. Not a woman at all. Only a blue would know, or even suspect. Salidar. Birthplace of Diana Ahriman, the blue sister who had become Amarlin after Bonwyn, and had rescued the tower from the ruin Bonwyn had poised it for. Salidar, one of the last places anyone would look for Aes Sedai, short of Amadicia itself. Two men in snowy cloaks and brightly burnished mail were riding down the street toward her, reluctantly moving their horses aside for wagons. Children of the Light. They could be found everywhere these days. Tipping her head down, watching the white cloaks cautiously from beneath the brim of her hat, Swan moved closer to the blue and green front of the inn. They glanced at her as they rode by, hard faces beneath shining conical helmets, and passed on. Swan bit her lip in vexation.
She had probably called their attention to her by shrinking back. And if they had seen her face? Nothing, of course. White cloaks might try to kill an Aes Sedai they found alone, but hers was an Aes Sedai face no longer. Only they had seen her try to hide from them. If Durunda Tharn had not upset her so, she would not have made such a foolish error. She could remember when a little thing like Mistress Tharn's remarks would not have made her stride waver in the least, when that overgrown, dyed fishwife would not have dared say a word of it. If that termagant doesn't like my manner, I'll... What she would do was continue about the business she was on before Mistress Tharn pummeled her, so she could not sit a saddle. Sometimes it was hard remembering the days were gone when she could call kings or queens and have them come. Striding down the street, she glared so hard that some of the wagon drivers bit back the comments they had been going to make to a pretty young woman alone. Some of them did. Min sat on a bench against the wall of the crowded common room in the nine-horse hitch, watching a table surrounded by standing men, some with coiled driver's whips, others wearing the swords that marked them merchants' guards. Six more sat shoulder to shoulder around the table. She could just make out Loghain and Lyanna sitting on the far side. He wore a disgruntled frown. The other men hung on Lyanna's every smiling word. The air was thick with pipe smoke and full of chatter that nearly drowned the music of flute and tambour and the singing of a girl dancing on a table between the stone fireplaces. Her song had to do with a woman convincing six men that each was the only man in her life. Min found it interesting, even when it made her blush. The singer darted jealous glances at the crowded table from time to time, or rather, at Lyanna. The tall Domani woman had already been leading Loghain by the nose when they entered the inn, and she had attracted more men like flies to honey with that swaying walk and the smoldering light in her eyes. There had very nearly been a riot, Loghain and the merchant's guards with hands on swords, knives being drawn, the stout proprietor and two heavily muscled fellows rushing in with cudgels. And Lyanna had doused the flames much as she had ignited them, with a smile here, a few words there, a pat on the cheek. Even the innkeeper had lingered a while, grinning like a fool, until his custom called him away. And Lyanna thought she needed practice. It hardly seemed fair. If I could do that to one particular man, I'd be more than satisfied. Maybe she'd teach me... Light! What am I thinking? She'd always been herself, and everyone else could accept her as she was or not. Now she was thinking about changing what she was for a man. It was bad enough that she had to hide herself in a dress instead of the coat and breeches she'd always worn. He'd look at you in a dress with neckline cut low. You've more to show than Lyanna does, and she... Stop that! We have to go south, Swan said at her shoulder, and Min gave a start. She had not seen the other woman come in. Now! From the shine in Swan's blue eyes, she had learned something. Whether she would share it was another matter. The woman seemed to think she was still Ammerlin, most of the time. We cannot reach anywhere else with an inn before nightfall, Min said. We might as well take rooms here for the night. It was pleasant to sleep in a bed again instead of under hedges and in haystacks, even if she did usually have to share it with Lyanna and Swan. Loghain was willing to rent them all rooms, but Swan was tight with their coin, even when Loghain was doling it out. Swan looked around, but whoever in the common room was not staring at Lyanna was listening to the singer. That isn't possible. I think some white cloaks may be asking questions about me. Min whistled softly. Dalin won't like that. Then do not tell him. Swan shook her head at the gathering about Lyanna. Just tell Amaina that we have to go. He'll follow. Let us just hope the rest don't as well. Min grinned wryly. Swan might claim that she did not care that Loghain, Dalin, had taken charge, mostly by just ignoring her whenever she tried to make him do anything, but she was still determined to bring him to heel again. What is a nine-horse hitch, anyway? She asked, getting to her feet. She had gone out front, hoping for a hint, but the sign over the door bore only the name.
I have seen 8 and 10, but never 9.
In this town, Swan said primly, it is better not to ask. Sudden spots of color in her cheeks made Min think that she knew very well. Go fetch them. We've a long way to go and no time to waste, and don't let anyone overhear you. Min snorted softly. With that small smile on Liana's face, none of those men would even see her. She wished she knew how Swan had brought herself to the White Cloak's attention. That was the last thing they needed, and it was not like Swan to make mistakes. She wished she knew how to make Rand look at her, like those men were looking at Liana. If they were going to be riding all night, and she suspected they were, maybe Liana would be willing to give her a few tips.
Chapter 12. An Old Pipe. A gust of wind, swirling dust down the Lugard Street, caught Gareth Bryn's velvet hat, sweeping it from his head directly under one of the lumbering wagons. An iron-rimmed wheel ground the hat into the hard clay of the street, leaving a flattened ruin behind. For a moment he stared at it, then walked on. It was showing travel stains anyway, he told himself. His silk coat had been dusty before reaching Murundi, too. Brushing no longer did much good, when he even took the trouble. It looked more brown than gray now. He should find something plainer. He was not on his way to a ball. Dodging between wagons rumbling down the rutted street, he ignored the driver's curses that followed him. Any decent squadman could give better in his sleep. And ducked into a red-roofed inn called the Wagon Seat. The painting on the sign gave the name an explicit interpretation. The common room was like every common room he had seen in Lugard. Wagon drivers and merchants' guards packed in with stablemen, farriers, laborers, every sort of man, all talking or laughing as loud as they could, while drinking as much as they could, one hand for the cup and one to fondle the serving girls. For that matter, it was not all that much different from common rooms and taverns in many other towns, though most were considerably milder. A buxom young woman, in a blouse that seemed about to fall off, capered and sang atop a table at one side of the room, to the supposed music of 2 flutes and a 12-string bittern. He had little ear for music, but he paused a moment to appreciate her song. She would have gone over well in any soldier's camp he had ever seen. But then, she would have been as popular if she could not sing a note. Wearing that blouse, she would have found a husband in short order. Johnny and Barham were already there, Johnny's size enough to grant them a table by themselves despite his thin hair and the bandage he still wore around his temples. They were listening to the girl sing, or at least staring at her. He touched each man on the shoulder and nodded toward the side door that led to the stable yard, where a sullen groom with a squint delivered their horses for 3 silver pennies. A year or so earlier, Bryn could have bought a fair horse for no more. The troubles to the west and in Carrion were playing havoc with trade and prices. No one spoke until they passed the city gates and were on a seldom-traveled road, winding north toward the River Storn, little more than a wide dirt track. Then Barim said, "They were here yesterday, my lord." Bryn had learned that much himself. 3 pretty young women together, obvious outlanders, could not pass through a city like Lugard without being remarked. By men, anyway. "Them and a fellow with shoulders," Barim went on. "Sounds maybe like that Dalin was with them when they burned down Nem's barn. Anyway, whoever he is, they was at the 9-horse hitch for a bit, but all they did was drink some and leave. That Domani girl the lads was telling me about, she nearly kicked up a fuss flashing her smile and swaying about, but then she calmed everything down again the same way. Burn me, but I'd like to meet me a Domani woman." "Did you hear which way they went, Barim?" Bryn asked patiently. He had not been able to learn that.
No, my lord.
but I heard there's been plenty of white cloaks passing through, all heading west. You think maybe old Pedron Niles planning something? Maybe in Altara? That's not our business anymore, Barham. Bryn knew his patient sounded a little frayed this time, but Barham was an old enough campaigner to stick to the matter at hand.
I know where they went, my lord, Johnny said. West, on the Johanna Road, and pushing hard by what I heard.
He sounded troubled.
My lord, I found two merchants' guards, lads who used to be in the guards, and had a drink with them. Happens they were in a stew called the Good Night's Ride when that girl Mara came in and asked for a job singing. She didn't get it. Didn't want to show her legs the way the singers in most of these places do, as who can blame her? And she left. From what Barham told me, it was right after that they all set off west. I don't like it, my lord. She isn't the kind of girl to want a job in a place like that. I think she's trying to get away from that Dolan fellow.
Strangely, despite the lump on his head, Johnny had no animosity toward the three young women. It was his opinion, often expressed since leaving the manor, that the girls were in some sort of predicament and needed to be rescued. Bryn suspected that if he did catch up to the young women and take them back to his estate, Johnny would be after him to turn them over to Johnny's daughters to mother. Barham had no such feelings.
Gil-Adan, he scowled, or maybe Altara, or Amadicia. We'll kiss the Dark One getting them back. Hardly seems worth the annoyance for a barn and some cows.
Bryn said nothing. They had followed the girl this far, and Murundi was a bad place for Andermen. Too many border troubles over too many years. Only a fool would chase into Murundi after an oathbreaker's eyes. How much bigger a fool to follow halfway across the world?
Those lads I talked to, Johnny said diffidently. My lord, it seems a lot of the old lads who served under you are being sent off.
Emboldened by Bryn's silence, he went on.
Lots of new fellows in. Lots. Those lads said at least four or five for everyone told he wasn't wanted anymore. The sort that like to cause trouble more than stop it. There's some calling themselves the White Lions who only answer to this Gabriel.
He spat to show what he thought of that.
And a bunch more, not part of the guards at all. Not house levies. Near as they could say, Gabriel's got 10 times as many men under arms as there are guards. And they've all sworn to the throne of Andor, but not to the Queen.
That's no longer our business either, Bryn said curtly. Barham had his tongue stuffed into his cheek, the way he always did when he knew something he either did not want to tell, or was not sure was important enough.
What is it, Barham? Out with it, man!
The leather-faced fellow stared at him in amazement. Barham had never figured out how Bryn knew he was holding back.
Well, my lord, some of the folks I talked to said some of those white cloaks yesterday was asking questions. About a girl, sounds like that Mara. Wanted to know who she was, where she went, like that. I heard they get real interested when they learned she was gone. If they're after her, she could be hanged before we ever find her. If they have to go to the trouble of chasing her down, they might not ask too many questions about whether she's really a Dark Friend, or whatever it is they're after her for.
Bryn frowned. White cloaks? What would the Children of the Light want with Mara? He would never believe she was a Dark Friend. But then he had seen a baby-faced young fellow hanged in Camelon, a Dark Friend who had been teaching children in the streets about the glories of the Dark One. The Great Lord of the Dark, he had called him. The lad had killed 9 of them in 3 years, as near as could be discovered, when they looked like turning him in.
No, that girl is no Dark Friend, and I'll stake my life on it.
White cloaks were suspicious of everyone, and if they took it into their heads that she had fled Lugard to avoid them. He booted Traveler to a canter. The big-nosed bay gelding was not flashy, but he had endurance and courage. The other two caught up soon enough, and they kept their mouths shut, seeing the mood he was in. 2 miles or so from Lugard, he turned off into a thicket of oak and leatherleaf. The rest of his men had made a temporary camp here, in a clear space under thick, spreading oak limbs. Several small, smokeless fires were burning. They would take any opportunity to brew up some tea. Some were dozing. Sleep was another thing an old soldier never missed a chance to snatch. Those awake kicked the rest out of their naps, and they all looked up at him. For a moment, he sat his saddle, studying them. Gray hair and bald heads and age-creased faces. Still hard and fit, but even so. He had been a fool to risk bringing them into Murindi just because he had to know why a woman had broken an oath. And maybe with white cloaks after them. No telling how far or how long from home before it was done. If he turned back now, they would have gone more than a month before they saw Khor Springs again. If he went on, there was no guarantee the chase would stop short of the Arath Ocean. He should be taking these men and himself home. He should. He had no call to ask them to try snatching those girls out of White Cloak hands. He could leave Mara to White Cloak justice. "We will be heading west," he announced, and immediately there was a scramble of dousing fires with the tea and fastening pots to saddles. "We will have to press hard. I mean to catch them in Altara if I can. But if not, there's no telling where they'll lead us. You could see Jahanna or Amador or Ebu Dar before we're done." He affected a laugh. "You'll find out how tough you are if we reach Ebu Dar. They've taverns there where the barmaids skin Ilianas for dinner and spit white cloaks for sport." They laughed harder than the jest was worth. "We won't worry with you along, my lord," Thad cackled, stuffing his tin cup into his saddlebags. His face was wrinkled like crumpled leather. "May I hear you had a run-in with the Amarlin herself once, and—" Jar Sylvan kicked him on the ankle, and he rounded on the younger man, gray-haired but still younger, with a clenched fist. "Why'd you do that, Sylvan? You want a broke head, you just—" "What?" The meaningful glares Sylvan and some of the others were giving him finally sank in.
Oh, yes."
He buried himself in checking the girth straps on his saddle, but no one was laughing anymore. Bryn forced his face to relax from stoniness. It was time he put the past in the past. Just because a woman whose bed he had shared, and more, he had thought, just because that woman looked at him as though she had never known him, was no reason to stop speaking her name. Just because she had exiled him from Camelon on pain of death, for giving her the advice he had sworn to give. If she came a cropper with this Lord Gabriel, who had suddenly appeared in Camelon, it was no longer any concern of his. She had told him, in a voice as flat and cold as smooth ice, that his name would never be spoken in the palace again, that only his long service kept her from sending him to the headsman for treason. Treason! He needed to keep spirits up, especially if this turned into a long chase. Hooking a knee around the high cantle of his saddle, he took out his pipe and pouch and filled his pipe with tabak. The bowl was carved with a wild bull collared with the rose crown of Andor. For 1,000 years, that had been the sign of the House of Bryn. Strength and courage in the service of the Queen. He needed a new pipe. This one was old. "I didn't come out of that as well as you might have heard." He leaned down from one of the men to hand him a twig still glowing from one of the spent fires, then straightened to puff his pipe alight. "It was some 3 years ago. The Amarlin was making a progression. Carrion, Tyr, Ilion, and finishing up in Camelon before returning to Tarvalen. At that time, we were having problems with Mirandian border lords, as usual." Laughter rippled. They had all served on the Mirandian border at one time or another. "I had sent some of the guards down to set the Mirandians straight on who owned the sheep and cattle on our side of the border. I never expected the Amarlin to take an interest." He certainly had their attention. Preparations to leave were still going on, but more slowly. Swan Sanche and Elida closeted themselves with Morgaze. There, he had said her name again, and it did not even smart. And when they came out, Morgaze was half Thunderhead, with lightning shooting out of her eyes, and half 10-year-old who'd been hauled up by her mother for stealing honey cakes. She's a tough woman, but caught between Elida and the Amarlin seat. He shook his head, and they chuckled. Aes Sedai attentions were one thing none of them envied lords and rulers. She ordered me to remove all troops from the border with Murindi immediately. I asked her to discuss it with me in private, and Swan Sanche jumped all over me. In front of half the court, she chewed me up one side and down the other like a raw recruit. Said if I couldn't do as I was told, she'd use me for fish bait. He had had to beg her pardon before it was done, in front of everyone, for trying to do as he had been sworn to do, but there was no need to do that. Even at the end, he had not been sure that she would not make Morgaze behead him, or have it done herself. "Must have meant to catch yourself a mighty big fish," someone laughed, and others joined in. "The upshot was," Bryn went on, "my hide got singed, and the guards were ordered back from the border. So if you're looking to me to protect you in Ibu Dar, just remember it's my opinion those barmaids would hang the Amarlin out to dry along with the rest of us." They roared with mirth. "Did you ever find out what it was about, my lord?" Johnny wanted to know. Bryn shook his head. "Aes Sedai business of some sort, I expect. They don't tell the likes of you and me what they are up to." That earned a few chuckles as well. They mounted up with an alacrity that belied their ages. "Some of them are no older than me," he thought wryly. Too old to go chasing after a pretty pair of eyes young enough to be his daughters, if not his granddaughters. "I only want to know why she broke oath," he told himself firmly. "Only that." Raising his hand, he signaled forward, and they headed west, leaving a trail of dust. It would take hard riding to catch up, but he meant to. In Ibu Dar, or the Pit of Doom, he would find them.
Chapter 13. A Small Room in Sienda. Elaine held herself against the swaying of the coach on its leather hinges, trying to ignore Nynaeve's sour face across from her. The curtains were drawn back despite a sprinkling of dust that sometimes whipped through the windows. The breeze blew away some of the late afternoon heat. Rolling forested hills streamed past, the woods occasionally broken by short stretches of farmland. A lord's manor, in the fashion of Amadisia, topped one of the hills a few miles from the road, a huge stone foundation 50 feet high, with an elaborate wooden structure atop that, all ornate balconies and red-tiled roofs. Once it all would have been stone, but many years had passed since a lord needed a fortress in Amadisia, and the king's law now required the wooden construction. No rebel lord would be able to hold out against the king for long. Of course, the Children of the Light were exempted from that law. They were immune to a number of Amadisian laws. She had had to learn something of the laws and customs of other countries from the time she was a child. Cleared fields dotted the distant hills, too, like brown patches on a mostly green cloth, the men working them seeming ants. Everything looked dry. One bolt of lightning would set a fire that could burn for leagues. But lightning meant rain, and the few clouds in the sky were too high and thin for that. Idly she wondered whether she could make it rain. She had learned considerable control over weather. Still, it was very difficult if you had to begin with nothing. "Is my lady bored?" Nynaeve asked acidly. "The way my lady is staring at the countryside, down my lady's nose, I think my lady must want to travel faster." Reaching back over her head, she pushed open a small flap and shouted, "More speed, Tom. Don't argue with me. You hold your tongue too, Jewelin thief-catcher. I said more speed." The wooden flap banged down, but Elaine could still hear Tom muttering loudly, cursing very likely,
Nynaeve had been barking at the men all day. A moment later his whip cracked, and the coach racketed ahead even faster, rocking so hard that both women bounced on the golden-colored silk seats. The silk had been thoroughly dusted when Tom bought the vehicle, but the padding had long since gone hard. Yet, jounced about as she was, the set of Nynaeve's jaw said she would not ask Tom to slow again right after ordering him to go faster.
"Please, Nynaeve," Elaine said.
The other woman cut her off.
"Is my lady uncomfortable? I know ladies are used to comfort, the sort of thing a poor maid wouldn't know about, but surely my lady wants to make the next town before dark, so my lady's maid can serve my lady's supper and turn down my lady's bed."
Her teeth clicked shut as the seat coming up met her coming down, and she glowered at Elaine as though it were her fault. Elaine sighed heavily. Nynaeve had seen the point back in Mardisin. A lady never traveled without a maid, and two ladies would probably have a pair. Unless they put Tom or Jewel in a dress, that meant one of them. Nynaeve had seen that Elaine knew more of how ladies behaved. She had put it very gently, and Nynaeve usually knew sense when she heard it. Usually, but that was back in Mistress Macura's shop, after they had filled the two women with their own horrible concoction. Leaving Mardisin, they had traveled hard until midnight to reach a small village with an inn, where they had roused the innkeeper from his bed to rent two cramped rooms with narrow beds, waking before first light yesterday to push on, skirting around Amador by a few miles. Neither of them would be taken for anything but what they claimed on sight, but neither felt comfortable about passing through a great city full of white cloaks. The Fortress of the Light was in Amador. Elaine had heard it said that the king reigned in Amador, but Padrone Nile ruled. The trouble had started last night at a place called Belen, on a muddy stream grandly named the Guyan River, some 20 miles or so beyond the capital. The Belen Ford Inn was larger than the first, and Mistress Alfara, the innkeeper, offered the Lady Morellin a private dining room, which Elaine could not very well refuse. Mistress Alfara had been sure that only the Lady Morellin's maid, Nana, would know how to serve her properly. Ladies did require everything just so, the woman said, as well they should, and her girls were simply not used to ladies. Nana would know exactly how the Lady Morellin wanted her bed turned down, and would prepare her a nice bath after a hot day of travel. The list of things that Nana would do exactly right for her mistress had been endless. Elaine was not sure whether Amadisian nobility expected such, or Mistress Alfara was just getting work out of an outlander's servant. She had tried to spare Nynaeve, but the woman had been as full of "as you wish" and "my lady is most particular" as the innkeeper. She would have seemed a fool, or at least odd, to press it. They were trying to avoid attracting undue attention. As long as they had been in Belen, Nynaeve had acted the perfect lady's maid in public. In private was another matter. Elaine wished the woman would just revert to herself instead of bludgeoning her with a lady's maid from the Blight. Apologies had been met with, "my lady is too kind," or simply ignored. "I will not apologize again," she thought for the 50th time. "Not for what was not my fault."
"I've been thinking, Nynaeve." Gripping a hanging strap, she felt like the ball in the children's game called Bounce in Andor, where you tried to keep a colorful wooden ball bouncing up and down on a paddle. She would not ask for the coach to be slowed, though. She could stand it as long as Nynaeve did. The woman was so stubborn. "I want to reach Tar Valon and find out what is going on, but my lady has been thinking. My lady must have a headache from all that effort. I will make my lady a nice tea of sheep's tongue root and red daisy as soon as—"
"Be quiet, Nana," Elaine said, calmly but firmly. It was her very best imitation of her mother. Nynaeve's jaw dropped.
"If you pull that braid at me, you can ride on the roof with the baggage."
Nynaeve made a strangled sound, trying so hard to talk that nothing came out. Quite satisfactory.
"Sometimes you seem to think I am still a child, but you are the one behaving like a child. I did not ask you to wash my back, but I would have had to wrestle to stop you. I did offer to scrub yours in turn, remember? And I offered to sleep in the trundle bed, but you climbed in and wouldn't get out. Stop sulking. If you like, I will be the maid at the next inn. It would probably be a disaster. Nynaeve would shout at Tom in public, or box someone's ears, but anything for a little peace. We can stop right now and change in the trees. We chose the gowns to fit you, the other woman muttered after a moment. Pushing the flap open again, she shouted, Slow down! Are you trying to kill us, fool men? There was dead silence from above as the coach's speed diminished to something much more reasonable, but Elaine would have wagered the two men were talking. She straightened her hair as best she could without a mirror. It was still startling to see those glistening black tresses when she did look in one. The green silk was going to need a thorough brushing itself. "What was it you were thinking, Elaine?" Nynaeve asked. Crimson stained her cheeks. At least she knew that Elaine was right, but backing down was very likely as much apology as she would ever give. "We are rushing back to Tar Valon, but do we really have any idea what awaits us in the tower? If the Ammerlin truly did give those orders, I do not really believe it, and I cannot understand it, but I do not intend to walk into the tower until I do. A fool puts her hand into a hollow tree without finding out what's inside first." "A wise woman, Lini," Nynaeve said. "We may learn more if I see another bunch of yellow flowers hanging upside down, but until then I think we should behave as though the Black Aja itself has control of the tower. Mistress Makura will have sent off another pigeon to Narenwin by now, with descriptions of this coach and the dresses we took, and most likely Tom and Julin too. It cannot be helped. This would not have happened if we hadn't dawdled across Tarabon. We should have taken ship." Elaine gaped at her accusatory tone, and Nynaeve had the grace to blush again. "Well, done is done. Moiraine knows Swan Sanche. Perhaps Egwene can ask her if—" Abruptly, the coach lurched to a halt, throwing Elaine forward on top of Nynaeve. She could hear horses screaming and thrashing as she frantically untangled herself, Nynaeve pushing her off as well. Embracing Sidar, she put her head out of the window and released it again in relief. Here was something of a sort that she had seen pass through Camelin more than once. A traveling menagerie was camped amid afternoon shadows in a large clearing by the side of the road. A great black-maned lion lay half asleep in one cage that took up the entire back of a wagon, while his two consorts paced in the confines of another. A third cage stood open. In front of it a woman was making two black bears with white faces balance themselves on big red balls. Another cage held what appeared to be a large hairy boar, except that its snout was too pointed, and it had toes with claws. That came from the Aiel waste, she knew, and was called a capar. Other cages held other animals and brightly colored birds, but unlike any menagerie she had ever seen, this one traveled with human performers. Two men were juggling ribbon-twined hoops between them. Four acrobats were practicing standing on one another's shoulders in a tall column, and a woman was feeding a dozen dogs that walked on their hind legs and did backflips for her. In the background, some other men were putting up two tall poles. She had no idea what they were for. None of that was what had the horses rearing in their harness and rolling their eyes, though, despite all that Tom could do with the reins. She could smell the lions herself, but it was at three huge, wrinkled gray animals that the horses gazed, wild-eyed. Two were as tall as the coach, with big ears and great curving tusks beside a long nose that dangled to the ground. The third, shorter than the horses, if likely as heavy, had no tusks. A baby, she supposed. A woman with pale yellow hair was scratching that one behind the ear with a heavy, hooked goad. Elaine had seen creatures like this before, too, and had never expected to see them again. A tall, dark-haired man strode out of the camp, of all things in this heat, wearing a red silk cloak that he flourished as he made an elegant bow. He was good-looking, with a well-turned leg, and very much aware of both things. "Forgive me, my lady, if the giant boar horses frightened your animals." As he straightened, he beckoned two of his men to help quiet the horses, then paused, staring at her, and murmured, "Be still, my heart."
It was just loud enough for Elaine to be sure she was supposed to hear. "I am Valan Luka, my lady, showman extraordinary. Your presence overwhelms me." He made another bow, even more elaborate than the first. Elaine shared a look with Nynaeve, catching the same amused smile that she knew she herself wore. A man very full of himself, this Valan Luka. His men did seem to be very good at soothing the horses. They still snorted and stamped, but their eyes were not so wide as they had been. Tom and Julin were staring at the strange animals almost as hard as the horses were.
"Boar horses, Master Luka," Elaine said. "Where do they come from?"
"Giant boar horses, my lady," was the ready reply. "From fabled Shara, where I myself led an expedition into a wilderness full of strange civilizations and stranger sights to trap them. It would fascinate me to tell you of them. Gigantic people twice the size of Ogier." He made grand gestures to illustrate. "Beings with no heads. Birds big enough to carry off a full-grown bull. Snakes that can swallow a man. Cities made of solid gold. Descend, my lady, and let me tell you." Elaine had no doubt that Luka would fascinate himself with his own tales, but she certainly doubted that those animals came from Shara. For one thing, even the sea folk saw no more of Shara than the walled ports they were confined to. Any who went beyond the walls were never seen again. The Aiel knew little more. For another, she and Nynaeve had both seen creatures like these in Falma during the Seanchan invasion. The Seanchan used them for work animals and for war.
"I think not, Master Luka," she told him.
"Then let us perform for you," he said quickly. "As you can see, this is no ordinary wandering menagerie, but something entirely new. A private performance. Tumblers, jugglers, trained animals, the strongest man in the world, even fireworks. We have an illuminator with us. We are on our way to Gildan, and tomorrow we will be gone on the wind. But for a pittance..." "My mistress said she thinks not," Nynaeve broke in. "She has better things to spend her money on than looking at animals." In fact, she herself kept a tight fist on all their coin, reluctantly doling out what they needed. She seemed to think everything should cost what it had back in her Two Rivers.
"Why would you want to go to Gildan, Master Luka?" Elaine asked. The other woman did make rough spots and leave them to her to smooth over. "I hear there is a great deal of trouble there. I hear the army has not been able to suppress this man called the Prophet with his preaching of the Dragon Reborn. Surely you do not want to travel into riots?"
"Greatly exaggerated, my lady, greatly exaggerated. Where there are crowds, people want to be entertained. And where people want to be entertained, my show is always welcome."
Luka hesitated, then stepped closer to the coach. An embarrassed look crossed his face as he gazed up into Elaine's eyes.
"My lady, the truth of the matter is that you would do me a very great favor by allowing me to perform for you. The fact is that one of the boar horses caused a little trouble in the next town up the road. It was an accident," he added hastily. "I assure you, they are gentle creatures, not dangerous at all. But not only are the people of Sienda unwilling to let me put on a show, or even come to one here, well, it took all of my coin to pay for the damages, and the fines," he winced, "especially the fines. If you allowed me to entertain you, for a trifle, truly, I would name you as patroness of my show wherever we go across the world, spreading the fame of your generosity, my lady..."
"Morellin," she said. "The Lady Morellin of House Samared." With her new hair, she could pass for Kyrianen. She had no time to see his show, as much as she would have enjoyed it another time, and she told him so, adding, "But I will help you a little if you have no money. Give him something, Nana, to help him on his way to Gildan." The last thing she wanted was him spreading her fame, but helping the poor and those in distress was a duty she would not slight when she had the means, even in a foreign land. Grumbling, Nynaeve dug a purse out of her belt pouch and dipped into it. She leaned out of the coach enough to press Luca's hand around what she gave him. He looked startled as she said, "If you took a decent job of work, you would not have to beg. Drive on, Tom."
Tom's whip cracked, and Elaine was thrown back into her seat. "You did not have to be rude," she said, "or so abrupt. What did you give him?"
"A silver penny," Nynaeve replied calmly, putting the purse back into her pouch, "and more than he deserved."
"Nynaeve," Elaine groaned, "the man probably thinks we were making sport of him."
Nynaeve sniffed. "With those shoulders, a good day's work would not kill him."
Elaine kept silent, though she did not agree. Not exactly. Certainly work would not harm the man, but she did not think there was much available. Not that I think Master Luca would accept work that didn't allow him to wear that cape. If she brought it up, though, Nynaeve would probably argue. When she gently pointed out things that Nynaeve did not know, the woman was quite capable of accusing her of having an arrogant manner, or of lecturing. And Valen Luca was hardly worth another altercation so soon after smoothing over the last. The shadows were lengthening by the time they reached Sienda, a sizable village of stone and thatch with two inns. The first, the King's Lancer, had a gaping hole where the front door had been, and a crowd was watching workmen make repairs. Perhaps Master Luca's boar horse had not liked the sign, propped up beside the hole now, a charging soldier with lance lowered. It seemed to have been ripped down somehow. Surprisingly, there were even more white cloaks in the crowded dirt streets than back in Mardisan. Far more, and other soldiers besides, men in mail and conical steel caps, whose blue cloaks bore the star and thistle of Amadicia. There must be garrisons nearby. The king's men and the white cloaks did not seem to like each other at all. They either brushed by as if the man wearing the wrong color did not exist, or else with challenging stares little short of drawn swords. Some of the white-cloaked men had red shepherd's crooks behind the sunbursts on their cloaks. The Hand of the Light, those named themselves, the hand that seeks out truth, but everyone else called them questioners. Even the other white cloaks kept clear of them. All in all, it was enough to make Elaine's stomach clench. But there was no more than another hour's sunlight left, if that, and that was taking into account the late summer sunsets. Even driving half the night again would not guarantee another inn ahead, and driving on this late might call attention. Besides, they had reason to halt early today. She exchanged looks with Nynaeve, and after a moment the other woman nodded and said, "We have to stop." When the coach drew up in front of the Light of Truth, Julin hopped down to open the door, and Nynaeve waited with a deferential look on her face for him to hand Elaine down. She did flash Elaine a smile, though. She would not slide back into sulks. The leather scrip she slung from her shoulder appeared a bit incongruous, but not too much so, Elaine hoped. Now that Nynaeve had acquired a stock of herbs and ointments again, she did not mean to let them out of her sight. From her first sight of the inn's sign, a flaring golden sun like that the children wore on their cloaks, she wished the boar horse had taken exception to this place instead of the other. At least there was no shepherd's crook behind it. Half the men filling the common room wore snowy white cloaks, their helmets set on the tables in front of them. She took a deep breath and a firm hold on herself not to spin on her heel and leave. Aside from the soldiers, it was a pleasant inn, with high-beamed ceilings and dark polished paneling. Cut green branches decorated the cold hearths of two large fireplaces, and good cooking smells wafted from the kitchens. The white-aproned serving-maids all seemed cheerful as they scurried among the tables, with trays of wine and ale and food. The arrival of a lady created little stir, this close to the capital, or perhaps it was because of that lord's manner. A few men looked at her, more eyed her maid with interest, though Nynaeve's stern frown, when she realized they were staring at her, quickly turned them back to their wine. Nynaeve seemed to think a man looking was a crime, even if he said nothing and did not leer. Given that, sometimes Elaine wondered why she did not wear less becoming clothes. She had had to work very hard to make sure that simple gray dress fit the other woman properly. Nynaeve was hopeless with a needle when it came to fine work. The innkeeper, Mistress Jaren, was a plump woman with long gray curls, a warm smile, and searching dark eyes. Elaine suspected she could spot a worn hem or a flat purse at 10 paces. They obviously passed muster, for she made a deep curtsy, spreading her gray skirts wide, and made effusive welcome, inquiring whether the lady was on her way to or from Amador. "From," Elaine replied with a languid hauteur. "The city's balls were most enjoyable, and King Aelron is quite as handsome as they say, which is not always so for kings, but I must return to my estates. I require a room for myself and Nana, and something for my footman and driver." Thinking of Nynaeve and the trundle, she added, "I must have 2 full beds. I need Nana close, and if she has only a trundle, she will keep me awake with her snoring." Nynaeve's respectful face slipped, just a fraction, thankfully, but it was quite true. She had snored terribly. "Of course, my lady," the plump innkeeper said. "I have just the thing. But your men will have to bed down in the stable in the hayloft. I'm quite crowded, as you can see. A troop of vagabonds brought some horrible great animals into the village yesterday, and one of them quite destroyed the king's lancer. Poor Sim has lost half his custom or more, and they've all come here." Mistress Jaren's smile was more satisfaction than commiseration. "I do have 1 room left, however."
"I'm sure it will do very well. If you will send up a light repast and some wash water, I think I shall retire early."
There was still sunlight showing in the windows, but she put a hand delicately over her mouth as if stifling a yawn.
"Of course, my lady. As you wish. This way."
Mistress Jaren seemed to think she had to keep Elaine entertained as she showed them to the 2nd floor. She went on the whole way about the crowding at the inn and how it was a miracle that she had a room left, about the vagrants with their animals and how they had been chased out of town and good riddance to rubbish, about all the nobles who had stayed at her establishment over the years, even the Lord Captain Commander of the Children once. Why, a hunter of the horn had come through just the day before on his way to Tyr, where they said the Stone of Tyr had fallen into the hands of some false dragon, and was it not horrible wickedness that men could do such things? "I hope they never find it." The innkeeper's gray curls swung as she shook her head.
"The Horn of Valyr," Elaine said. "Why ever not?"
"Why, my lady, if they find it, it means the last battle is coming. The Dark One breaking free."
Mistress Jaren shivered.
"The light send the horn is never found. That way the last battle cannot happen, can it?"
There did not seem to be much answer to such curious logic. The bedchamber was snug, if not exactly cramped. 2 narrow beds with striped coverlets stood to either side of a window looking out onto the street, and little more than walking room separated them from each other or the white-plastered walls. A small table holding a lamp and tinderbox between the beds, a tiny flowered rug, and a washstand with a small mirror above it completed the furnishings. Everything was clean and well-polished, at least. The innkeeper plumped the pillows and smoothed the coverlets and said the mattresses were the best goose down, and the lady's men would be bringing her chests up by the back stairs, and everything would be very cozy. There was a good breeze at night if the lady opened the window and left the door cracked. As though she would sleep with her door open to a public hallway. 2 aproned girls arrived with a large blue pitcher of steaming water and a large lacquered tray covered with a white cloth before Elaine managed to get Mistress Jaren out. The shape of a wine pitcher and 2 cups mounded up one side of the cloth.
"I think she believed we might go to the King's Lancer even with a hole in it," she said, once the door was firmly shut.
Looking around the room, she grimaced. There would barely be room for them and the chests.
"I am not certain we shouldn't."
"I do not snore," Nynaeve said in a tight voice.
"Of course you do not. I had to say something, though."
Nynaeve gave a loud harumph, but all she said was,
"I am glad I am tired enough to go to sleep. Aside from that fork root, I did not recognize anything to aid sleep in what that Makura woman had."
It took Tom and Julin 3 trips to bring the iron-bound wooden chests up, grumbling all the while, the way men did, about having to haul them up the narrow stairs at the rear of the inn.
They were muttering about being made to sleep in the stables, too, when they brought in the first one between them. It had leaf-shaped hinges. The bulk of their money and valuables were in the bottom of that, including the recovered Turang Rial. But one glance at the room, and they shared a look and shut their mouths. About that, at least.
"We're going to see what we can learn in the common room,"
Tom said once the last chest was jammed in. Barely enough space remained to reach the washstand.
"And maybe take a walk around the village," Julin added. "Men talk when there's as much dislike as I saw in the street."
"That will be very good," Elaine said. They did so want to think they had more to do than Hall and carry. It had been so in Tanchico, and Mardisin, of course, and might well be again, but hardly here.
"Do be careful not to get into any trouble with the White Cloaks now."
A long-suffering look passed between them, just as if she had not seen them both with bruised and bleeding faces after jaunts for information. But she forgave them and smiled at Tom.
"I cannot wait to hear what you learn."
"In the morning," Nynaeve said firmly. She was looking away from Elaine so hard that she might as well have been glowering at her. "If you disturb us before then for less than Trollocs, you'll learn the reason why." The glance that passed between the two men spoke volumes. It made Nynaeve's eyebrows rise sharply. But once she had reluctantly handed over a few coins, they left, agreeing to let the women sleep untroubled.
"If I cannot even speak to Tom," Elaine began when they were gone.
But Nynaeve cut her off. "I'm not having them walk in on me asleep in my shift." She was awkwardly undoing the buttons down the back of her dress. Elaine went to help her, and she said, "I can manage. You get the ring out for me." With a sniff, Elaine pulled up her skirt to reach the small pocket she'd sewn to the underside. If Nynaeve wanted to be peevish, let her. She would not respond even if Nynaeve began ranting again. There were two rings in the pocket. She left the golden great serpent she had been given on being raised to accepted, and took out the stone ring. All flecks and stripes of red and blue and brown, it was just too large to fit a finger, and flattened and twisted besides. Odd as it seemed, the ring had only one edge. A finger drawn along that edge would circle inside and out before coming back to where it began. It was a Turang Rial, and what it did was allow access to Telairun Riod, even for someone who did not have the talent that Egwene and the Aiel Dreamwalkers shared. All that was needed was to sleep with it next to your skin. Unlike the two Turang Rial they had recovered from the Black Aja, it did not require channeling. For all Elaine knew, even a man might be able to use it. Clad only in her linen shift, Nynaeve threaded the ring onto the leather thong with Lan's signet and her own great serpent, then re-knotted and hung it back around her head before lying down atop one of the beds. Carefully tucking the rings in next to her skin, she settled her head on the pillows.
"Is there time before Egwene and the Wise Ones get there?" Elaine asked. "I can never reason out what hour it is in the waste."
"There's time unless she comes early, which she won't. The Wise Ones keep her on a very short leash. It will do her good in the long run. She was always headstrong."
Nynaeve opened her eyes, looking right at her.
"At her? As if that could stand for her as well."
"Remember to tell Egwene to let Rand know that I am thinking of him." She was not going to let the woman start a row. "Tell her to... tell him that I love him, and only him."
There. She had it out. Nynaeve rolled her eyes in what was really a most offensive way. "If you wish me to," she said dryly, snuggling herself into the pillows. As the other woman's breathing began to slow, Elaine pushed one of the chests against the door and sat on it to wait. She always hated waiting. It would serve Nynaeve right if she went down to the common room. Tom would probably still be there and nothing. He was supposed to be her coachman. She wondered whether Nynaeve had thought of that before agreeing to be the maid. With a sigh, she leaned back against the door. She did hate waiting.
Chapter 14.
Meetings. The effects of the ring Tarangrial did not startle Nynaeve any more. She was in the place she had been thinking of when sleep closed in, the great chamber in Tyr called the Heart of the Stone, within the massive fortress called the Stone of Tyr. The gilded stand lamps were unlit, but pale light seemed to come from everywhere and nowhere, to simply be, all around her, fading into dim shadows in the distance. At least it was not hot. It never seemed hot or cold in Telairunriod. Huge redstone columns ran off in every direction, the vaulted dome far above lost in dim shadows, along with more golden lamps hanging on golden chains. The pale floorstones beneath her feet were worn. The High Lords of Tyr had come to this chamber, in the waking world, of course, only when their law and custom demanded, but they had come ever since the breaking of the world. Centered beneath the dome was Kalendor, apparently a glittering sword made of crystal, driven half its length into the stone of the floor, just as Rand had left it. She did not go near Kalendor. Rand claimed to have woven traps around it with Sidene, traps that no woman could see. She expected they would be nasty. The best of men could be vicious when they tried to be devious. Nasty, and just as primed for a woman as for the men who might use that Sangreal. He had meant to guard it against those in the tower as much as the Forsaken. Aside from Rand himself, the one who touched Kalendor might die, or worse. That was a fact of Telairunriod. What was in the waking world was here too, although the reverse was not always so. The world of dreams, the unseen world, reflected the waking world, if sometimes in odd ways, and perhaps other worlds as well. Verin Sedai had told Egwene that there was a pattern woven of worlds, of the reality here and others, just as the weaving of people's lives made up the pattern of the ages. Telairunriod touched them all, yet few could enter except accidentally, for unknowing moments during their own mundane dreams. Dangerous moments for those dreamers, though they never knew it unless they were very unlucky. Another fact of Telairunriod was that what happened to the dreamer here happened in the waking world, too. To die in the world of dreams was to die in fact. She had the sensation of being watched from the dimnesses between the columns, but it did not trouble her. It was not Mogadine. Imaginary eyes. There are no watchers. I told Elaine to ignore them, and here I... Mogadine would certainly do more than look. Even so, she wished she were angry enough to channel. Not that she was frightened, of course. Only not angry. Not frightened at all. The twisted stone ring felt light, as if it were trying to drift up out of her shift, reminding her that she was wearing only that. As soon as she thought of clothing herself, she was in a dress. It was a trick of Telairunriod that she liked. In some ways, channeling was unnecessary, for here she could do things that she doubted any Aes Sedai had ever done with the power. It was not the dress she had expected, though. Not good, stout Two Rivers wool. The high neck, trimmed in Gyra Cruz lace, came right up under her chin, but pale yellow silk draped her in folds that clung revealingly. How many times had she called Tara Bonner gowns like this indecent when she had worn them to blend into Tanchico? It seemed that she had grown more used to them than she knew. Giving her braid a sharp pull for the waywardness of her own mind, she left the dress as it was. The gown might not be as she wanted, but she was no flighty girl to go leaping and squealing over it. A dress is a dress. She would wear it when Egwene arrived, with whichever of the wise ones accompanied her this time, and if any of them said a word, "I did not come early to blather at myself about dresses." "Birgitta?" Silence answered her, and she raised her voice, though it should not have been necessary. In this place this particular woman could hear her own name spoken on the other side of the world. "Birgitta?" A woman stepped out from among the columns, blue eyes calm and proudly confident, her golden hair in a long braid more intricate than Nynaeve's own. Her short white coat and voluminous yellow silk trousers, gathered at the ankles above short boots with raised heels, were garments of more than 2,000 years ago that she had taken a liking to. The arrows in the quiver at her side appeared to be silver, and so did the bow she carried.
"Is Gaedal about?" Nynaeve asked. He was usually close by Brigitta, and he made Nynaeve nervous, refusing to acknowledge her existence, scowling when Brigitta spoke to her. It had been something of a shock at first to find Gaedal Kane and Brigitta, long-dead heroes linked in so many stories and legends, in Tel Iron Riod. But, as Brigitta herself had said, where better for heroes bound to the wheel of time to await rebirth than in a dream? A dream that had existed as long as the wheel. It was they, Brigitta and Gaedal Kane and Rogosh Eagle-Eye and Arthur Hawkwing and all the others, that the Horn of Valir would summon back to fight at Tarmon Gaiden. Brigitta's braid swung as she shook her head.
"I've not seen him for some time. I think the wheel has spun him out again. It always happens so."
Expectation and concern both touched her voice. If Brigitta was right, then somewhere in the world a boy child had been born, a mewling babe with no knowledge of who he was, yet destined for adventures that would make new legends. The wheel wove the heroes into the pattern as they were needed, to shape the pattern, and when they died, they returned here to wait again. That was what it meant to be bound to the wheel. New heroes could find themselves bound so as well, men and women whose bravery and accomplishments raised them far above the ordinary, but once bound, it was forever. "How long do you have?" Nynaeve asked. "Years yet, surely." Brigitta was always tied to Gaedal, had been tied in story after story, in age after age of adventure and a romance that even the wheel of time did not break. She was always born after Gaedal, a year, or five, or ten, but after. "I do not know, Nynaeve. Time here is not like time in the waking world. I met you here last 10 days gone, as it seems to me, and Elaine only a day before. What was it for you?"
4 days and three," Nynaeve muttered.
She and Elaine had been coming to speak with Brigitta as often as they could, though too frequently it had not been possible with Tom and Julin sharing the camp and standing night guard. Brigitta actually remembered the War of Power, one lifetime of it anyway, and the Forsaken. Her past lives were like books fondly remembered from long ago, the more distant dimmer than the nearer, but the Forsaken stood out, especially Mogadine.
"You see, Nynaeve, the flow of time here can shift in larger ways, too. It might be months before I am born again, or days, here, for me. In the waking world, it could be years yet before my birth."
With an effort, Nynaeve suppressed her vexation. "Then we mustn't waste what time we have. Have you seen any of them since we last met?" There was no need to say who.
"Too many. Lanfear is often in Tel Iron Riod, of course, but I have seen Ravin and Samael and Grendal, Demondred and Semirag."
Brigitta's voice tightened at the last name. Even Mogadine, who hated her, did not frighten her visibly, but Semirag was another matter. Nynaeve shivered as well. The golden-haired woman had told her too much of that one, and realized she was wearing a thick wool cloak, with a deep hood pulled up to hide her face. Flushing, she made it disappear.
"None of them have seen you?" she asked anxiously.
Brigitta was more vulnerable than herself in many ways, despite her knowledge of Tel Iron Riod. She had never been able to channel. Any of the Forsaken could destroy her as if crushing an ant, without breaking stride. And if she were destroyed here, there would be no rebirth for her ever again.
"I'm not so unskilled or so foolish as to allow that."
Brigitta leaned on her silver bow. Legend said she never missed with that bow and her silver arrows. "They are concerned with each other, not anyone else. I have seen Ravin and Samael, Grendal and Lanfear, each stalking the others unseen, and Demondred and Semirag each shadowing them as well. I've not seen so much of them here since they were freed."
"They are up to something," Nynaeve bit her lip in vexed frustration. "But what?"
"I cannot say yet, Nynaeve. In the War of the Shadow, they were always plotting against each other as often as not, but their work has never boded well for the world, waking or dreaming. Try to find out, Birgitta, as much as you can safely at any rate. Do not take any risks. The other woman's face did not change, but Nynaeve thought she was amused. The fool woman thought as little of danger as did Lan. She wished she could ask about the White Tower, about what Swan might be scheming, but Birgitta could neither see nor touch the waking world unless she was called there by the horn. You are just trying to avoid what you really want to ask. Have you seen Mogadin? No, Birgitta sighed, but not for lack of trying. In the usual course I can find anyone who knows they are in the world of dreams. There is a feel, like ripples spreading through the air from them, or perhaps from their awareness. I do not know, really. I am a soldier, not a scholar. Either she has not come in to tell Irunriod since you defeated her, or... She hesitated, and Nynaeve wanted to stop her from saying what she knew would come next, but Birgitta was too strong to dodge unpalatable possibilities. Or else she knows I have been looking for her. She can hide, that one. She is not called the Spider for nothing. That was what a Mogadin had been in the Age of Legends, a tiny spider that spun its webs in secret places, its bite poison enough to kill in heartbeats. Suddenly very much aware of feeling unseen eyes, Nynaeve shivered heavily. It was not trembling, just a shiver, not trembling. Still, she kept the sleek Tarabonner gown firmly in mind, lest she abruptly find herself wearing armor. It was embarrassing enough if that sort of thing happened when she was alone, even more under the cool blue gaze of a woman valiant enough to be a match for Gaedal Kane. Can you find her even when she wants to remain hidden, Birgitta? It was a very great deal to ask, if Mogadin knew she was being hunted, like searching for a lion in high grass armed only with a stick. The other woman did not hesitate. Perhaps. I will try. Hefting her bow, she added, I must go now. I do not want to risk being seen by the others when they come. Nynaeve put a hand on her arm to stop her. It would be a help if you let me tell them. That way I could share what you've told me about the Forsaken with Egwene and the Wise Ones, and they could tell Rand. Birgitta, he needs to know. You promised, Nynaeve. Those bright blue eyes were unyielding as ice. The prescripts say that we must not let anyone know that we reside in Tel Irunriod. I have broken many by speaking to you, much more by giving aid, because I cannot stand by and watch you battle the Shadow. I have fought that battle in more lifetimes than I can remember, but I will keep as many of the prescripts as I can. You must hold to your promise. Of course I will, she said indignantly, unless you release me from it. And I do ask you to... No. And Birgitta was gone. One moment Nynaeve's hand rested on a white coat sleeve, the next on empty air. In her mind she ran through a few curses she had overheard from Tom and Julin, the sort she would have scolded Elaine for listening to, much less using. There was no point calling Birgitta's name again. She probably would not come. Nynaeve only hoped she responded the next time she or Elaine called. Birgitta! I will keep my promise, Birgitta! She would have heard that. Perhaps by their next meeting she would know something of Mogadin's activities. Nynaeve almost hoped she would not. If she did, it meant that Mogadin really was stalking Tel Irunriod. Fool woman! If you don't look for snakes, you cannot complain when one bites you. She really did want to meet Elaine's Leany one day. The emptiness of the vast chamber oppressed her, all those great polished columns and that sense of being watched from the dimness between. If there really was anybody there, Birgitta would have known. She realized that she was smoothing the silk gown over her hips, and to take her mind off eyes that were not there, she concentrated on the dress. It had been in good Two Rivers woolens that Lan had first seen her, and a simple embroidered dress that she'd been wearing when he professed his love. But she wanted him to see her in gowns like this. It would not be indecent if he was the one seeing her. A tall standing mirror appeared, casting her reflection as she turned this way and that, even peering back over her shoulder. The yellow folds sheathed her closely, suggesting everything they hid. The women's circle in Emmons Field would have hauled her off for a good talking to in private, wisdom or no wisdom. Yet it was quite beautiful. Here, alone, she could admit that she had a bit more than gotten used to wearing something like this in public. "You enjoyed it," she scolded herself. "You are every bit as much a hussy as Elaine seems to be turning into." But it was beautiful. And maybe not as immodest as she had always said. Not a neckline cut halfway to her knees, like the first of Maine, for instance. Well, perhaps Bear Elaine's were not that low, but they were still far deeper than respectability required. She had heard about what Damani women often wore. Even Tara Bonner's called those indecent. With the thought, the yellow silk folds became rippling flows, with a narrow belt of woven gold. And thin. Her face colored. Very thin. Barely opaque at all, in fact. The gowns certainly did more than suggest. If Lan saw her in that, he would not gabble that his love for her was hopeless and that he would not give her widow's weeds for a bridal gift. One glimpse and his blood would catch fire. He would... "What under the light is that you have on, Nynaeve?" Egwene asked in scandalized tones. Nynaeve leaped straight up, spinning, and when she came down facing Egwene and Milane, it would be Milane, though none of the wise ones would have been any better. The mirror was gone, and she was wearing a dark woolen Two Rivers dress thick enough for the depths of winter. Mortified at being startled as much as anything else, it was mainly at being startled, she changed the dress instantly, without thinking, flashing back into the gossamer Damani, and just as quickly to the yellow Tara Bonner folds. Her face flamed. They probably thought her a complete fool, and in front of Milane at that. The wise one was beautiful, with her long red-gold hair and clear green eyes. Not that she cared a whit how the woman looked, but Milane had been at her last meeting here with Egwene, too, and taunted her about Lan. Nynaeve had lost her temper over it. Egwene claimed they were not taunts, not among Aiel women, but Milane had complimented Lan's shoulders, and his hands, and his eyes. What right did that green-eyed cat have to look at Lan's shoulders? Not that she had any doubts of his faithfulness, but he was a man, and far away from her, and Milane was right there, and... Firmly she put a stop to that line of reasoning. "Is Lan..." She thought her face was going to burn off. "Can't you control your own tongue, woman?" But she would not, could not, back away. Not with Milane there. Egwene's bemused smile was bad enough, but Milane dared to put on a look of understanding. "Is he well?" She tried for cool composure, but it came out strained. "He is well," Egwene said. "He worries about whether you are safe." Nynaeve let out a breath she had not realized she was holding. The waste was a dangerous place even without the likes of Kuladin and the Shido, and the man did not know the meaning of caution. He was worried about her safety? Did the fool man think she could not take care of herself? "We finally reached Amadicia," she said quickly, hoping to cover herself. A flapping tongue and then sighs. "The man has stolen my wits." There was no telling from the others' faces whether she was succeeding. "A village called Sienda, east of Amador. White cloaks everywhere, but they don't look at us twice. It is others we have to worry about." In front of Milane, she had to be careful, to bend the truth a little, in fact, here and there. But she told them of Rhonda Macura and her odd message, and her trying to drug them. Trying, because she could not make herself admit in front of Milane that the woman had succeeded. "Light, what am I doing? I've never lied to Egwene before in my life." The supposed reason, the return of a runaway accepted, certainly could not be mentioned, not in front of one of the wise ones. They thought that she and Elaine were full Aes Sedai, but she had to let Egwene know the truth of that somehow. It might have to do with some plot concerning Andor, but Elaine and you and I have things in common, Egwene, and I think we should be just as careful as Elaine. The girl nodded slowly. She looked stunned, as well she might, but she seemed to understand. A good thing the taste of that tea made me suspicious. Imagine trying to feed fork root to someone who knows herbs as well as I do.
Schemes within schemes, Milane murmured. The great serpent is a good sign for you, Aes Sedai, I think. Some day you may swallow yourselves by accident.
We have news ourselves, Egwene said. Nynaeve could see no reason for the girl's haste. I'm certainly not going to let the woman bait me into losing my temper, and I certainly wouldn't get angry over her insulting the tower. She took her hand away from her braid. What Egwene had to say put temper right out of her head. Cooladine crossing the spine of the world was surely grave, and Rand following scarcely less so. He was pushing hard for the Jangai Pass, marching from first light until after dusk, and Milane said they would soon reach it. Conditions in Kyrian were harsh enough without a war between Aiel on its territory, and a new Aiel war to come, surely, if he tried to carry out his mad plan. Mad. Not yet, surely. He had to hang on to sanity somehow. How long since I was worrying how to protect him, she thought bitterly. And now I just want him to stay sane to fight the last battle. Not only for that reason, but for that one, too. He was what he was. The light burned me. I'm as bad as Swan Sanche or any of them. It was what Egwene had to say about Moiraine that shocked her.
She obeys him? She said incredulously.
Egwene gave a vigorous nod in that ridiculous Aiel scarf. Last night they had an argument. She's still trying to convince him not to cross the dragon wall, and finally he told her to stand outside until she cooled down. She looked about to swallow her tongue, but she did it. She stayed out in the night for an hour anyway.
It is not proper, Milane said, resettling her shawl firmly. Men have no more business ordering Aes Sedai about than they do wise ones, even the Kara Karn.
They certainly do not, Nynaeve agreed, then had to clamp her mouth shut to keep from gaping at herself.
What do I care if he makes her dance to his tune? She has made all of us dance to hers often enough. But it was not proper. I do not want to be Aes Sedai just to learn more about healing. I want to stay who I am. Let him order her about. Still, it was not proper.
At least he talks with her now, Egwene said. Before he turned to acid if she came within 10 feet of him.
Nynaeve, his head swells bigger every day.
Back when I thought you'd follow me as wisdom, Nynaeve told her wryly, I taught you how to take swelling down. Best for him if you do it, even if he has turned into the king bull in the pasture. Maybe most because he is. It seems to me that kings and queens can be fools when they forget what they are and act like who they are, but they're worse when they only remember what they are and forget who. Most could do with someone whose only job is to remind them that they eat and sweat and cry the same as any farmer.
Milane folded her shawl around her, seeming unsure whether to agree or not, but Egwene said,
I try, but sometimes he doesn't seem like himself at all, and even when he is, his arrogance is usually too thick a bubble to prick. Do the best you can. Helping him hold on to himself may be the best thing that anyone could do, for him and the rest of the world.
That produced a silence.
She and Egwene certainly did not like to talk about the eventuality of Rand going mad, and Milane could not like it any better.
I have something else important to tell you, she went on after a moment. I think the Forsaken are planning something.
It was not the same as telling them about Brigitta. She made it seem that she herself had seen Lanfear and the others. In truth, Mogadine was the only one she could recognize at sight, and maybe Asmodeon, though she had only seen him once, and at a distance. She hoped neither of them thought to ask how she knew who was who, or why she thought Mogadine might be skulking about. In actuality, the problem did not arise from that at all.
"Have you been wandering the world of dreams?" Milane's eyes were green ice.
Nynaeve met her level stare for level stare, despite Egwene's rueful head-shaking. I could hardly see Ravine and the rest without it, now could I?
Aes Sedai, you know little and you try too much. You should not have been taught the few pieces that you have. For myself, I sometimes regret that we agreed even to these meetings. Unschooled women should not be allowed in Tel Irunriod.
I have schooled myself in more than you ever taught me. Nynaeve kept her voice cool with an effort. I learned to channel on my own, and I do not see why Tel Irunriod should be any different. It was only stubborn anger that made her say that. She had taught herself to channel, true, but without knowing what it was that she was doing and only after a fashion. Before the White Tower she had healed sometimes, but unaware, until Moiraine proved it to her. Her teachers in the tower had said that was why she needed to be angry in order to channel. She had hidden her ability from herself, afraid of it, and only fury could break through that long-buried fear.
So, you are one of those the Aes Sedai call wilders.
There was a hint of something in the last word, but whether scorn or pity, Nynaeve did not like it. The term was seldom complimentary in the tower. Of course, there were no wilders among the Aiel. The wise ones who could channel found every last girl with the spark born in her, those who would develop the ability to channel sooner or later, even if they did not try to learn. They claimed also to find every girl without the spark who could learn if instructed. No Aiel girl died trying to learn by herself.
You know the dangers of learning the power without guidance, Aes Sedai. Do not think the dangers of the dream are less. They are just as great, perhaps more for those who venture without knowledge.
I am careful, Nynaeve said in a tight voice. She had not come to be lectured by this sun-haired vixen of an Aiel.
I know what I am doing, Milane.
You know nothing. You are as headstrong as this one was when she came to us.
The wise one gave Egwene a smile that actually seemed affectionate. We tamed her excessive exuberance, and now she learns swiftly, though she does have many faults still. Egwene's pleased grin faded. Nynaeve suspected that grin was why Milane had added the last. If you wish to wander the dream, the Aiel woman went on, come to us. We will tame your zeal as well, and teach you.
I do not need taming, thank you very much, Nynaeve said with a polite smile.
Ah, Nalain will die on the day he learns that you are dead.
Ice stabbed into Nynaeve's heart. Ah, Nalain was what the Aiel called Lan. One man, it meant in the old tongue, or man alone, or the man who is an entire people. Exact translations from the old tongue were often difficult. The Aiel had a great deal of respect for Lan, the man who would not give up his war with the Shadow, the enemy that had destroyed his nation.
You are a dirty fighter, she muttered.
Milane quirked an eyebrow.
Do we fight? If we do, then know that in battle there is only winning and losing. Rules against hurting are for games. I want your promise that you will do nothing in the dream without first asking one of us. I know Aes Sedai cannot lie, so I would hear you say it.
Nynaeve gritted her teeth. The words would be easy to say. She did not have to hold to them. She was not bound by the three oaths. But it would be admitting that Milane was right. She did not believe it, and she would not say it.
She'll not promise, Milane, Egwene said finally. When she gets that muley look, she wouldn't come out of the house if you showed her the roof on fire.
Nynaeve spared a piece of glare for her. Muley, indeed, when all she did was refuse to be pushed about like a rag doll.
After a long moment, Milane sighed. Very well. But it would be well to remember, Aes Sedai, that you are but a child in Tel Irunriod. Come, Egwene, we must go. An amused wince crossed Egwene's face as the two faded away. Abruptly, Nynaeve realized that her clothes had changed. Had been changed. The wise ones knew enough of Tel Irunriod to alter things about others as well as themselves.
She wore a white blouse and a dark skirt, but unlike those of the women who had just gone, this stopped well short of her knees. Her shoes and stockings were gone, and her hair was divided into two braids, one over each ear, woven with yellow ribbons. A rag doll with a carved and painted face sat beside her bare feet. She could hear her teeth grinding. This had happened once before, and she had pried out of Egwene that this was how the Aiel dressed little girls. In a fury, she switched back to the yellow Tarabonner silk. This time it adhered even more closely, and kicked the doll. It sailed away, vanishing in midair. That Malayne probably had her eye on Lan. The Aiel all seemed to think he was some sort of hero. The high neck became a tall lace collar, and the deep, narrow neckline showed her cleavage. If that woman so much as smiled at him, if he... Suddenly she became aware of her fast-sinking, rapidly widening neckline, and hastily brought it back up. Not all the way, but enough that she did not have to blush. The dress had grown so tight that she could not move. She took care of that, too. So she was supposed to ask permission, was she? Go begging the wise ones before doing anything? Had she not defeated Mogadine? They had been properly impressed at the time, but they seemed to have forgotten. If she could not use Birgitta to find out what was going on in the tower, perhaps there was a way she could do it herself. Chapter 15. What Can Be Learned in Dreams. Carefully, Nynaeve formed an image in her mind of the Ammerlin's study, just as she had envisioned the Heart of the Stone on going to sleep. Nothing happened, and she frowned. She should have been taken to the White Tower, to the room she had visualized. Trying again, she imagined a room there that she had visited much more often, if more unhappily. The Heart of the Stone became the study of the Mistress of Novices, a compact, dark-paneled room full of plain, sturdy furnishings that had been used by generations of women who had held that office. When a novice's transgressions were such that extra hours of scrubbing floors or raking paths would not atone, it was here that she was sent. For an accepted to receive that summons took a greater transgression, but still she went, on leaden feet, knowing the outcome would be just as painful, perhaps more so. Nynaeve did not want to look at the room. Shiriam had called her willfully stubborn on her numerous visits, but found herself staring into the mirror on the wall, where novices and accepted had to look at their own weeping faces while listening to Shiriam lecture about obeying the rules, or showing proper respect, or whatever. Obeying others' rules and showing required respect had always tripped up Nynaeve. The faint remnants of guilt on the carved frame said it had been there since the War of the Hundred Years, if not the Breaking. The Tarabonner dress was beautiful, but anyone who saw her in it would be suspicious. Even Domani women usually dressed circumspectly when they visited the tower, and she could not imagine anybody dreaming of herself in the tower except on her best behavior. Not that she was likely to meet anyone, except perhaps someone who had dreamed herself into Tel-Irun Riad for a few moments. Before Egwene, there had not been a woman in the tower who could enter the world of dreams unaided since Corianna Nadil, over 400 years ago. On the other hand, among the Turangrial stolen from the tower that were still in the hands of Leandrin and her confederates, 11 had last been studied by Corianan. The two others of Corianan's study, the two that she and Elaine had in hand, both gave access to Tel-Irun Riad. It was best to assume that the rest did, too. There was small chance that Leandrin or any of the others would dream themselves back to the tower they had fled, but even that chance was too big to risk, when it might mean being waylaid. For that matter, she could not really be sure that the stolen Turangrial were all that Corianan had investigated. The records were often murky about Turangrial no one understood, and others could very well be in the hands of black sisters, still in the tower. The dress changed completely, became white wool, soft but not of a particularly fine quality, and banded at the hem with 7 colored stripes, one for each Aja. If she saw anyone who did not vanish after a few moments, she would take herself back to Sienda, and they would think she was only one of the accepted,
touching Telairunriod in her dreams. No, not the inn, but Shiriam's study. Anyone like that would have to be Black Aja, and after all, she was supposed to be hunting them. Completing her disguise, she gripped her suddenly red-gold braid and grimaced at Milane's face in the mirror. Now there was a woman she would like to hand over to Shiriam. The study of the Mistress of Novices was near the novices' quarters, and the wide tiled hallways flickered with occasional motion past elaborate wall hangings and unlit stand lamps, flashes of frightened girls all in novice white. A good many novice nightmares would contain Shiriam. She ignored them as she hurried by. They were not in the world of dreams long enough to see her, or if they did, they would simply think her part of their own dream. It was only a short climb up broad stairs to the Ammerlin's study. As she approached, suddenly Elida was in front of her, sweaty-faced in a blood-red gown, the stole of the Ammerlin's seat around her shoulders. Or almost the Ammerlin's stole. It had no blue stripe.